Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. We are so glad you're here with us tonight. My AccuWindow forecast tonight, about 49 degrees and rainy everywhere on Earth, just about. Here in eastern Kentucky, we're coming to you live. The solar wind is holding at 364.4 kilometers per second. Sunspot 1042 is passing across the sun as we speak. It is large and a member of solar cycle 24. Looks like we're in for a very active year. Solar flare from sunspots will cause havoc with satellites, which can knock out cell phones and wireless internet connections. Last year, when NASA's IBEX spacecraft discovered a ribbon at the edge of the solar system, researchers were mystified. They called it a shocking result and puzzled over its origin. "We believe the ribbon is a reflection," says Jacob Herrenkjusen, a NASA heliophysicist, guest investigator from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. It is where solar wind particles heading out into interstellar space are reflected back into the solar system by a galactic magnetic field. The solar system is passing through a region of the Milky Way filled with cosmic rays and interstellar clouds. The magnetic field of our own sun, inflated by the solar wind into a bubble called the heliosphere, substantially protects us from these things. However, the bubble itself is vulnerable to external fields. A strong magnetic field just outside the solar system could press against the heliosphere and interact with it in unknown ways. Will this strengthen our natural shielding or weaken it? No one can say. Old sunspot 1039 still has some life left in it. Yesterday, it unleashed a strong solar flare and triggered a solar tsunami. The eruption, which took place on the far side of the sun, was invisible from Earth. Nevertheless, NASA's Stereo B spacecraft had a new great view. Stereo B is stationed over the sun's eastern limb, where it can see things we cannot. Solar rotation is slowly turning sunspot 1039 back toward our planet, and Stereo B will keep an eye on it as it approaches. When Lawrence Reese was cleaning up his sub shop in Lorton, Virginia, late Monday afternoon, he heard a tremendous impact outside. Something had come hurtling out of the sky and crashed through the roof of a nearby doctor's office, landing in an empty examination room. The debris was smoldering and metallic. The two physicians puzzled over the item. Whatever had come through the roof had broken into several pieces. The two doctors speculated that part of an airliner had come off and fallen through their roof. A nearby circular hole was punched through the building's roof. An acquaintance suggested the possibility of a meteorite, so the debris was sent to the Smithsonian Natural History Museum in nearby Washington, D.C. "It's definitely a meteorite," concluded Linda Welzenbach, who oversees the museum's collection of natural space objects. "It was a black fusion crust, which tells us that it passed through the atmosphere. Most meteorites are small, about the size of a pea. The one that landed in Lorton was bigger than a human fist before it broke into pieces inside the doctor's office." Good thing that examination room was empty. Just as reincarnation has functioned as a connection and balance, so too has the concept of tikkun, that's fixing ourselves and the world. Now is the time to utilize our abilities to connect beyond both of those ideas. Mankind must cross the chasm that has separated it from the original source of life. It is time to enact the proper resurrection and transformation that is required to rebalance and fix this planet. That's a quote from Rabbi Yossi. NASA's newest space telescope, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, that's called WISE, is expected to be an excellent hunter of dark asteroids. On January 12th, WISE made its first catch, a kilometer-class space rock named 2010 AB78. If researchers are correct, this is just the first of hundreds of near-Earth objects and hundreds of thousands of main-belt asteroids that WISE is capable of finding. Now that could be interesting. We definitely want to keep up with that telescope. It's doing a great job. My guest tonight is Jonathan Elenoff. His website is newworldorderreport.com. We'll be with him in 40 seconds. Don't go away. We'll be back. X Squared Radio. I want to thank everyone for their emails. We don't normally do conspiracy theories on this program. You can just kind of get caught in the quicksand and down the hole you go. However, I have had a lot of mail and a lot of suggestions that we should get a credible conspiracy theory expert on the program. I've done some research, and the best out there, as far as I'm concerned, Jonathan Elenoff. He's our guest tonight. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me, as always. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, you know, I'm in new territory here. We normally talk about science, and we talk about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And one of the interesting things that people keep bringing up to me is the category of conspiracy theories. We don't normally do them on this program, but I really wanted to tread carefully in this water because it is so turbulent, and it's such a quagmire, it seems. Most talk radio programs that cover this don't do a very good job, but yours, New World Order Report, does a fantastic job, and I've seen several of your YouTube clips, and I've talked to some of your fans, and I'm very impressed with how thorough you are and how you vet the information before you put it out there.
Well, thank you. That's something I take a lot of responsibility for. I only get into something if I can find credible sources on it. If I can't, I just tell people, you know, look, I'm familiar. I know what's out there, what people are saying, but unless we can get a credible source on it, you know, it's just talk. And that's how I look at conspiracy theories. Obviously, there are conspiracies that take place. We have a justice system because people conspire. But my whole thing is, you know, and I'm longtime reader and researcher in organized crime and history major, and I specialized in recent history, black ops, things like that. So the conspiracy theories I always found an interest in naturally were ones that involved politics more than anything else. But over the last, I'd say, 10 years or so, I started realizing that there is a large movement, if you will, awakening to not just conspiracy theories, but everything. It's hitting pop culture. It's now trend. I just finished a book on trends, and it actually says that this is the next trend in our pop culture is alternative history, conspiracy theory, things like that. This is the new trend. It is now hip. All the artists, the screenwriters, the actors and celebrities and the writers and the musicians and everyone in society who's really shaping our consciousness, if you will, or playing a part in reflecting it, has now come out in support of pretty much conspiracy theories, whether it's vaccinations or 9/11 or whatever, you know, whatever it is, a HARP. Everybody somewhere seems to be on board with something, and then we're all communicating now because of the internet. So the next trend now is the rest of culture, the rest of society is going to take a few years, but it's a ripple effect. They're going to go where the artists are going, and if you pay attention, you know probably as well as I do, I'm going to the Television Producers Convention in Las Vegas this week, which is the next 3 days. Everybody out there, all the producers, all my friends in Hollywood, all the writers, the hottest thing right now is conspiracy theories. If you've got a movie about conspiracy theories, you got a good chance of it. I'm serious. You got a good chance of it getting picked up. So it's going to get interesting these next few years as this gets popular.
I was featured on True TV, which had a segment now that's called Conspiracy Theories with Jesse Ventura, and his first episode covered HARP, which myself and Dr. Nick Begich and a couple of others are longtime experts on that weapon system, and I actually built an experiment and demonstrated it on the program to prove to people that clouds can actually be moved with electromagnetic pulses. I use the almost identical pulses that HARP uses, only I only use 100 watts instead of a billion, but nevertheless, in the cloud chamber, it was clearly obvious that you could move clouds inside the chamber with the fields. And there's been a lot of press lately about this earthquake in Haiti. And it was interesting. I went to your website, and sure enough, there was a link to this, and it's really something about, it says, a most grim report from Russian Space Forces, VKS, monitoring the United States High-Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, is warning today that the Americans are preparing for another potentially devastating earthquake test on a scale comparable to the one that destroyed the Caribbean island nation of Haiti, and which we had previously reported on in January 14th report titled U.S. Quake Test Goes Horribly Wrong, Leaves 500,000 Dead in Haiti. I don't know if there's 500,000 dead in Haiti, but it was a heck of a headline. It goes on to say the reason for this new American quake test, these reports say, is due to the catastrophic failure of their previous ones that have so destabilized our Earth's inner magnetosphere that more earthquakes have been reported in the past 30 days than in the first 90 days of 2009, including, and this is really spooky stuff, including over 600 alone at the potentially catastrophic Yellowstone volcanic cauldron, and that have caused more loss of life than in previous 5 years all put together. What's going on with HARP? What are you hearing out there?
I saw a report from a lab in England, and I also posted that on my website. And the European Space Program also confirmed the report, and I found two credible sources saying that electromagnetic rifts were detected during and just before the quake in Haiti. And they did say, and they got into specifics, that it was in the upper atmosphere specifically, and they even got into theories as to what it could be. They're trying to look for external, but from what the resources that sent me this said was this is actually direct evidence of HARP because of what they discovered, what they're able to show with their data. And so that was kind of my first opening to the possibility HARP was used on Haiti. That was how I opened up to that. I'm familiar that HARP has been used before, and what's really unfortunate about this current situation we're facing is there is very few people who understand just how powerful and how this technology works. And luckily, you know, thanks to people like you, and I'm very proud that Jesse Ventura's show had 1.5 million viewers on that first episode. That was amazing, his ratings. We've never seen that much attention to this stuff.
No, we're
going to see more people. We're going to see more people waking up to this issue, not just HARP, but the other issues in the environment, and I'm kind of really concerned right now with not just HARP, but I think that there's other technology that they're playing with. I do get a lot of emails from people who check my website. People send me interesting stuff. And, you know, I've heard so much stuff out there, little experiments and things, and I've seen a lot of the videos, and I've met a few of the people. I'm really curious to know what's going to happen in these next few years now that this information is so readily available and so many people are aware of it. Are people going to try to replicate this technology? Are people going to try to do this in their backyard? You know, I'm concerned with where this is going to end up.
Well, it does take a lot of power to get involved in this game in a serious way. And also, you need an FCC license in order to broadcast in these frequencies, because they're actually the one in Alaska is in the 2 meter band, which is why ham operators around the world act kind of as watchdogs. They know when this thing is fired up. They don't know exactly where it's aimed, because that's part of the design of the system. First of all, they fire it up, push the ionosphere up into space 30, 50, 80 kilometers, and they shape it into a sort of parabolic mirror, as it were, and then they bounce their ELF, the extremely low frequencies, off that mirror and direct them to wherever they want them to go on the Earth. Now, the problem with the system is, of course, the ELF waves can resonate deep within the Earth, sort of like an MRI of the Earth, and they can resonate with unstable portions of the Earth, 70, 80, 90 miles down into the Earth. And all it really takes is a resonance to build on itself, sort of like when you hum in the bathroom and you have one frequency that seems louder than all the other frequencies. It's because the bathroom is just the right size for those waves to build on one another in the bathroom. Well, that's what happens deep in the Earth as well. And if there's an instability in the Earth, then that's just the trigger that lets it go. Now, one of the reasons that I was asked to be on True TV is I used to use HARP-style frequencies as a ground-probing radar in the oil and gas industry, and I was very successful with it. I happened to be in Oregon in 1987 in Roseburg, Oregon, and we were looking for a gas well to feed a fescue operation that was there, and we had set up one morning. I was in the control camper, and my mobile unit had gone out about 3/8 of a mile away, and I communicated. It was foggy. I communicated with him by radio and asked him, go ahead and turn the transmitter on. He turned the transmitter on, and 2 seconds later, the whole camper rocked like a big someone had just grabbed the carpet and whipped it. And I said, I called back to him, and I said, hey, did you feel that? He said, yeah. He said, I turned on the transmitter, and right underneath me, it sounded like dynamite went off deep in the earth, and I think it was an earthquake. I said, wow, did we do that? Anyway, I marked it in the lab notebook. It never happened again. But the interesting thing was that we made the observation that it very well could have been that we had a cause and effect on that quake.
Right, and I don't know if you saw this. There were reports of descriptions of what was heard in Haiti just before the earthquake hit was loud bangs. I don't know if you saw that. I remember seeing that report, and somebody sent this to me and said, you know, this is evidence of HARP. And just hearing you describe what you just said, when you said it sounded like TNT, it makes me think of this link. I didn't post it on my site, but I did get sent this email saying that that was a description of what the earthquake sounded like, was these loud bangs underneath the ground, and then the earthquake followed. Very interesting that that's seems to be maybe some synchronicity there. You know, the other thing is, of course, we have to look at this prospect of the aftermath of what Haiti did. There's that U.S. military intel report. They did a strategic planning contingency for Haiti disaster relief of an earthquake just before the strike. Now, the reason why this is interesting, I studied black ops. Usually, it's not uncommon to see contingencies in the Pentagon. That's kind of what their job is. There's a contingency for just about everything. There's contingencies for aliens landing. I mean, there's just contingencies for everything. But when they come out with a very specific contingency like that, and they plan for the actual how are we going to deal with this scenario, and then it happens right then. We saw this with the supposed flu pandemic. This is actually pretty common in a lot of events, but it did happen in the case of Haiti. That way the military can come out and then say, oh, yeah, we were prepared. We know how to respond to this. Because what people have to understand, when the military responds to a situation, it can be standard protocol, but it can also be very chaotic. So they usually have protocols and plans, and they send it out. It's all on a wire. It's all information sent, ready to go. Every department knows how to respond, and everyone's ready to go into action. That has to be planned. That actually has to be strategically planned beforehand. So I found it interesting when that report came out, because that was confirmed that the military did plan for that disaster relief right before the quake hit. And, of course, they went into action right afterwards, and we know now from the aftermath, it's disaster capitalism. I mean, they're going to rebuild it. They're going to be there a long time. They're loaning the country money now. They're even turning away planes that are trying to send aid because the military is running it. It has a monopoly. So it's just very interesting watching that, because to me that says something right there. That shows interests at work. So,
well, a lot of people don't know that there has not been a serious quake in Haiti for about 200 years. It's not one of the more probable places to have an earthquake. It would seem to me that if they were going to plan a contingency, that they would have done something, you know, where one of the quakes has been happening, like maybe the Philippines or maybe, Yellowstone or something like that. But to plan it in Haiti is a little bit low probability. And the odds of those two mutually exclusive events actually happening are astronomical. Couple that with the fact that the Americans were actually dreadfully slow and ill-prepared to respond to this from a medical standpoint. It was actually the Israelis that had two jets land and had a fully modern hospital up and running within hours of the quake.
Right. I did see some reports about people saying that there might be some trafficking going on. I wasn't able to get some confirmation on this, but I did see the early reports on this. There could be, you know, this trafficking, organ trafficking issue that happened that was busted earlier last year, if you're familiar. That involved some people who were in custody in the war on terror. When that came out, that was kind of shocking. I was telling people, you know, for years, this was like taboo in my circles. You know, I have Jewish family and friends, and I mean, that's like, you can't get more taboo than that. Somebody say, you know, they're harvesting Palestinian organs. And then all of a sudden this huge organ trafficking ring gets busted, and they find out, oh, yeah, by the way, some of their sources are people in the jails. I was like, what? Who's the report? I found it was like Guardian, BBC. I'm like, whoa. Oh, boy. That's hot. That's a hot story, man. And nobody wanted to touch it. And that's the unfortunate reality in this country. You can't really talk about certain things because people don't know how to interpret information. They think, oh, you must be against or for certain countries or issues. It's hard for people to be objective about anything involving Israel. But of course, like you pointed out, Israel landed in Haiti, and sure enough, a lot of early reports said that there might be some trafficking again of some of the people that are, you know, can't be saved, or who knows, they're going to take those organs. It sounds crazy, but the value of organs on the black market is something that's extremely, if you study the black market, you know, they trade in everything, not just cocaine and heroin, guns and everything like that. The black market includes diamonds, it includes organs, nuclear products, you know, all kinds of things. So there is an interest. Very powerful people are interested in harvesting organs. Is it possible? I don't know. I guess anything's possible. But I was not able to find direct confirmation of that report. So, something to think about.
Well, man, I tell you, there is a lot going on out there. I have a tendency to think that maybe ethics have always been lacking when we're talking about governments, whether we're talking about King John or whether we're talking about Hitler or whether we're talking about our own government. The temptation to take advantage of the disenfranchised seems to be just beyond people, whether it's taking control of the world's healthcare or taking manipulating world currencies. One of the conspiracies that my listeners keep writing in about is this conspiracy that global currencies are being manipulated. Now it's not much. It's only, you know, a fraction of a percent per day. But the banks, the global banks, and even the national banks in this country are putting their depositors' money into these money trading operations, and they're actually making between 40 and 60% interest on their money by moving, not interest, profits, by moving depositors' money sometimes 1,000, 1,500 times a month in and out of these global currencies, manipulating them back and forth. Meanwhile, they're not lending their money to their communities, which are in desperate need for credit and access to capital to start businesses. And because of this, the ripple effect, at least what we've been able to see, is that small business is about out of business.
That's right. That's absolutely right. You couldn't be more right, actually. The interesting thing about the global currency situation, for a long time it was rumored to have a world centralized banking system. After this economic collapse, which many people out there know, that myself and other people, famous people like Ron Paul, Alex Jones even, there are people out there who were for years talking about how they're pumping up the economy, they're going to crash it, they're going to intentionally create a vacuum. We see what you're doing. We know about this derivatives market. I mean, there were people talking about this before the crash hit. A lot of them. My friend and attorney Gary Fielder, he's one of them. He came out with a film a while ago called "The Gig Is Up." It's on Google Video for free. My point is that when the crash happened, almost every major publication, and you can't get more credible than some of these publications like Time and Washington Post and New York Times, came out discussing. First of all, they were using terminology like the New World Order. And the second, which is out of nowhere, I was like, okay, well, thank you for you're going to fuel so many conspiracy theories again. But, you know, that was a shock to me that they would use that terminology again, bring it back from the 90s. I thought that was a dead terminology, but it's alive and well. And they even used the terminology of global currencies and world trading agreements with centralized banks on the global scale. Some of the reports I was reading, and even the op-ed pieces from the major publications, I mean, you couldn't get more specific with stuff I was hearing about in conspiracy theories 20 years ago. I mean, it was like they read those same books and then said, yeah, well, maybe this is the solution. I'm like, okay, yeah, sure, it's a solution, but you do realize this was foreseen by a lot of conspiracy theorists. If you want to fuel the conspiracies more, then please continue talking like this because you're not helping the situation. And my whole point is... obviously that is the interest. I mean, the old game of empire here is it's as old as time, but the situation we're facing, they're manipulating the markets because they have to have their control. There has to be a valve at the top. And, you know, it's obvious if you look at the last 60-year span of foreign politics and actual foreign affairs, it's obvious there is a common direction. There is a common agenda. And that agenda is centralization, larger trading agreements, and more deregulations. It's going in one direction. It only goes in one direction, and it takes advantage of as many crises as it can. That's the history of this international foreign policy when it comes to economics specifically. These trading agreements tend to do that. Now we saw this with the European Union. It was almost immediately when it came about that the currency was pushed, and everyone said, "No, that's too quick," and then it came out. The stability of that currency is helping sell the idea of maybe a world currency. And that stability of a global currency is actually very popular among countries like Russia and China, who openly declared their support for a world currency. I don't know if you can recall the Time magazine article where China called for a world currency.
They've actually done it twice. And it's interesting because China is artificially, by decree, holding their currency artificially low to stimulate foreign investment. And it's working. Every country is investing in China. We're buying truck gliders from them right now for our electric car company. So I know exactly why they're doing it. But You're exactly right. Currencies have condensed of late, basically into four major currencies. You have the euro, the pound, the yuan, and the dollar. And it's even the dollar and the yen kind of competing with one another, although I don't see the yen surviving much longer.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you there. A lot of people are talking about the collapse of the dollar. Collapse of the dollar is possible. It might not be quick to come. If it is something that happens quickly, I would be the first to come out and say this was intentional, and there's probably going to be, like, remember how the Patriot Act was passed within a few days. They said, oh, we've got to quickly respond. If there's any sudden collapse of a currency, it's probably intentional, and then there's probably some legislation that will be pushed rather quickly. Of course, any legislation will be accepted in a crisis like that without even reading it. So you have to remember, when people talk about the collapse of the currency, I say, well, yeah, if it happens, of course it's going to be intentional, but nobody's going to care. Everyone's assets, I don't have liquid assets. I mean, I don't have any liquid assets, but then again, I'm smart with my money. I try to keep my money I try to keep my money in real assets. But I know a lot of people who, first of all, how many people do you know that live check to check? I mean, everyone lives paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah,
and you have a lot more people. Yeah, and then everyone has their investments. And how many people have, even the middle class, the upper middle class, the upper class, they all have their investments. A currency collapse would mean you would gain, 90-some-odd% of the people's support for whatever legislation you pass, so long as you get them their money back. They don't care what they have to do.
Well, I always say that it would be an easy sell if they just came to the people and said, look, we really need to, for instance, come up with the Amero, because there's too much disparity between the Canadian dollar, the U.S. dollar, and the peso. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to compete with these global economies, since, for instance, the American auto industry stretches from Toronto all the way down to Torreón in Mexico, having one currency would greatly stabilize a multi-billion dollar industry. And I don't know how real the Amero is. I've seen it on national news. I've seen pictures of it. I see it on the internet. I've never held one in my hands. But if that were to happen...
There's some credible discussion of it. The Amero was long time discussed in the mid-90s, was the first introduction of the idea. It goes into the late 90s where it started losing its popularity. We started hearing about it in just about 2003, 2004, when it was starting to break onto the public sphere. I heard that, and this is from sources I trust very much, I have a few friends that have a lot of wealth. The interest at this point is something that probably won't be so much an Amero, so much as they might even go much larger of a currency. I've heard discussion is popular among some of these elite think tanks that they're trying to push a larger trading currency, maybe backed by the World Bank. And that's actually now that also is not as popular as the Amero, but it is being discussed. Something like that would also stabilize the markets on a scale we've never seen. But also, that would also skip a few steps. Maybe they could do that. Maybe they could suddenly do that. I mean, the markets are so interdependent right now, and you have so many countries that, I mean, let's face it, it's the upper class elite private sector, which are the government in every capitalist society right now. And they're pretty much all deciding everything, and they're all pretty much on the same page. They're just trying to figure out how to go to the people and sell them policies. That's what a politician is. Their job is to go to the people and sell them the policies they have to write for the rich people. Which is that's just the reality. You know what I mean? And juggle between the public and you know.
I wonder how even necessary it is anymore. I mean, we look at what's going on in this country. We have virtually no one that's in support of what the administration is doing, and yet they're pouring ahead full speed, manipulating the press by keeping them out of key meetings, producing documents that are several hundred pages, even 1,000 pages long, not giving anyone on the committee time to read it. Go ahead and vote yes, and we'll solve it later. You know how it's done here in Washington. It's clear that somebody is making this policy, and I guess my question is, which we never talk about on this program, but we're going to tonight, who's making this global policy? Who's putting all this together? You talk about the wealthy. Most of the wealthy I know are in competition with one another. They're not cooperating with each other.
Well, it's kind of like mafias. You've got a game they all share. Okay, they all share in their cartels, but they're competing for power constantly. Their territories are being debated over who's controlling. There's inner fighting. That's just how it is. But if anything comes together and threatens that mafia, they will band together and secure their interests. And that's kind of what you have with policy in government, is you have different lobbyist groups, large corporate interests, and then you have think tanks. These are the three categories. Now, your lobbyists generally don't bother with pushing anything. They generally just buy a politician, campaign him into office, and then hand off the legislation and tell him who to pardon. And it's usually small like that. That's usually the history of lobbyists. When it comes to think tanks usually campaign for very powerful people like the president. And then when the president gets in, they usually make suggestions on who to be in which cabinets, which tend to be their own members. Now, these people usually have policies written and pre-approved and debated by different think tanks. So the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, for example, are very influential in helping advise the government. Now, they're unelected bodies, but there's nothing illegal about advising. However, it is still treasonous. I mean, it is a very gray zone area. They're unelected officials. There is direct evidence that they've actually handed not just a suggestion, but actual policy off. A lot of people think the president is kind of like the decision maker in the office. It's actually more like the president goes in and he gets advised by these other cabinet members who he had to put in by suggestions of people who made his campaign. So the cabinet makes more decisions, if anything. They're the ones really writing the policy. It's more complicated than people give it credit for. And they usually have the policy and go to the president and say, here's what the policy is. I need your signature. You know, go ahead and put your John Hancock and let's check this through. And that policy is usually heavily influenced by the think tank, not anyone else. So it's the way they bypass the people is very clever. And that's really how you deal with it. I mean, and the other thing is you have to remember, it's very common for like the CEO of Monsanto to become the head of the Department of Agriculture. It's very common for defense contractors to become Secretary of State, or Defense Secretary. There's this theme in the cabinet where not only are they tend to be members of the same think tanks, they also tend to fill the positions that benefit their own interests. It's a revolving door where they kind of lock arms and dance to their loo, and they just, you know, there's no difference between big corporations and big government. They're kind of the same thing when you talk about that level of politics. When you're talking about local and state, no, not really. Not really. They can really, their focus on local and state is more voting and the election process and making sure certain people remain in the Congress. That's about it, and senators. But when it goes to the federal level, their control is more so in the cabinets. So that's kind of how it works. And then you have your different corporate interests, you know, the banking cartels, clearly behind this bailout. Remember during the oil cartels, remember when oil was skyrocketing, we were paying ridiculous amounts for gas, and oil companies were reporting record profits every quarter.
Oh, sure.
And what are we seeing right now with the bailout banks? Record profits for companies that were bailed out. Now, it's kind of the same thing. So in that case, what you have is an obvious sign of these cartels making a move for their own interests. And that's kind of how it works. They unless they're really competing against each other directly, they just kind of let each other in once in a while at the trough, turn on the faucet, and feed themselves. And they kind of have this little game. And one of their oldest tricks is using the Republican-Democratic paradigm, the right-left paradigm, against the people. Very old strategy, divide and conquer. And people downplay that a lot.
I mean, we see this on a national level. Like, even in our industry, in the automotive industry, we see a Secretary Chu of the DOE, and we hear him come out publicly and say he's going to do a lot for electric cars. And we hear Obama say, oh, yes, electric vehicles, we'll support battery companies and electric vehicles, and we're going to help small business and innovation. And nothing. Absolutely nothing even close to that actually happened. And Secretary Chu, making his reports this last week, was asked repeatedly, what are you going to do about electric vehicles? I mean, there's no electric vehicles. No money is going to electric vehicle companies. When are you going to start helping them? And he's, you know, kind of passed it off and said, well, you know, it's more complicated than it looks, and, you know, we can't really do that. And what he's effectively saying is, look, we're in the car business now, all right? So we can't make electric cars, because if we do, we're going to hurt our car company. So, you know, that's what it boils down to. But this is on a national level. When we go to Washington, and we often do go to D.C., we talk to our senator, our congressman, and different committees and administrations. Nothing gets done on a federal level. They always send you back to the state. Go back to the state. They're the ones that have the money. They have the programs. They have the ground level stuff. So you come back to the state and they say, well, you know, the federal government hasn't given us any money to do this, and we'd have to tax our own people, and we can't do that. We'd rather tax people in other states. And that's how they have to go back to the federal government. So it's a big circle, but this is all national stuff. I'm talking about global policy. It, on the surface, in the news, it looks like the United States is competing with the rest of the world, with Russia, with China, with Japan, with Germany, with you know, the oil cartels. But that's not actually what we see on a very high level. Right. We see profiteering on an unbelievable scale, not just in money, but in resources and human capital.
Right. If I had to take my guess, I would, and this is an educated guess, I would go on the global scale and say that, you know, first of all, the post-Cold War, you know, you have a War Department. There's always operations. The interest of the military is to maintain security for the nation and increase our influence over the sphere we call the Earth. Those operations continued post-World War II. We called it the Cold War. Now, when the Cold War ended, intelligence agencies didn't just disappear. The Pentagon wasn't shut down. It all still existed. It just changed tactics, had to look for new enemies, continue expanding its influence.
Sure.
So that plays a factor when you're talking about, for example, the KGB history over in Russia. Look at the whole story about Litvinenko. I can't remember his name, the Russian that was poisoned, the journalist, ex-KGB
right.
agent who turned whistleblower. He was exposing Vladimir Putin's rise to power from Borisovsky and saying that they used false flag terrorism to bring him to power. And he was immediately considered a threat to everyone, so he was brought over to England. And the one man who killed him, Lugovoy, who probably did kill him, let's face it, the radiation was found in all three places Lugovoy was in, he won't even confess to it. We know it was him. Now what does that tell you? It tells you something about the old KGB has been completely hijacked by the CIA. That's what we learned from that whole incident. From the Western intelligence apparatus, I shouldn't say just the CIA. It includes MI5. It also includes Mossad and some others.
Yeah, I don't know that it was actually hijacked. I think they're all in cahoots with each other. I mean, just go back to World War II. Go back to the bomb in Hiroshima. We not only did not have the right trigger device, we certainly did not have an implosion device even close, but we did make the casing for it. The bomb was actually made in Germany. It was brought over on a U-boat, flown to the base in New Mexico, loaded into the casing, which it perfectly fit, by the way, loaded onto the airplane, flown to Japan, and it worked. It detonated the first time.
Right.
Now, that's not a hijack. That's collusion.
Right. Well, the Western intelligence apparatus is largely the same people. One of the things I did learn was the old takedown of Europe, dating back now before World War I, going into the Round Table Networks and some of the banks that took down the monarchies. You know, that all did happen. The wars were funded by a lot of the same interests and the same sides at the very top. What we see during World War I is that expansion of those interests. Of course, they established the Federal Reserve here and then continued that sphere of influence. Now, post-World War II, when they set up some of the larger entities like the World Bank and the UN, the IMF, things like that, they're still playing their game. Now, the Western intelligence apparatus is essentially a part of one security state. One thing that people have to understand is the security clearances. There are two pyramids of control. There's the pyramid we think of, which is there's local, state, federal government, you know, and then there's just all compartmentalized, and each department has a boss, and that boss has a boss and a supervisor, and this, and the buck stops at the president. That's the public idea of control. Then there's the other sphere, the other pyramid, I should say, which is actually the real one. This is called the national security state. This is security clearances. Security clearances are issued to people involved in military operations. And in a country like ours, where we have private sector doing high-level, top-secret stuff, they have to be given security clearances, including agents on the ground. Contract agents in the CIA or NSA are technically in the forefront. Now, you could be working for the Naval Intelligence, or you could be working for the CIA, or you could be working for any military intelligence. You could be working for anyone. But your security clearance is actually what matters. It doesn't matter which branch of the military you are, or even if you're CIA or NSA. What matters is the people deciding that's the operation that they're going to use you on have a higher security clearance, and they know everyone with the lower security clearances. They have access to you. So it's no longer compartmentalized by different military branches. And these security clearances, by the way, go higher than the president. They go higher than the nation. Banks and big corporations do have security clearances. Now, these people can pull security clearances from now different countries. Someone from MI5 can be pulled, Mossad and also CIA can be pulled in a joint operation. That doesn't mean that these agencies are together. They're still separate compartmentalizations. But the security clearances allow anybody with a high enough access to pull anyone they want from below the pyramid. Now, the Western establishment is one general empire, one interest, one general group of fighting interests, but they share in their empire. And that's kind of what you have. Post-World War II, in the establishment of the Cold War, I mean, we all know communism was funded from its inception in Wall Street, also from the financial district in London. When they pulled the rug on communism in the late 80s, of course it collapsed. The whole funding mechanism behind it was dead. And then you saw Borisovsky. Borisovsky comes into Russia, largely turns the economy over into a capitalist system and brings Vladimir Putin to power, ex-KGB. Now, a lot of these old Cold War echoes come to light in the 90s. That's where you get Osama bin Laden. That's where you get a lot of people who were ex-assets from this Cold War. It's not uncommon. Now, what we're facing with today is a very small resistance to the final phases, which I believe is going to be countries like Iran, maybe Syria, Cuba. These are countries that are truly ones that are really not on board.
The rogue nations that have under the radar, under the smokescreen, in the dark of night, under the guise of religious freedom, have put together at least the ability to stick the thumb in the eye of this pyramid of secrecy. My question is, and my observation is, you know, a pyramid goes up to a point. Sure, we're talking about levels of security clearances and people being able to pull assets from lower levels. Who is at the top?
The best evidence we've seen, in according to the credibility, and this is something I did in Core Corruption, there's L. Fletcher Prouty. Now, can we trust what he says? Well, he did run black ops at a height of the Cold War. It is fair to say he's credible. Does that mean that we can trust him? Well, anybody in military intelligence could be pulling a disinformation operation. One of the things we have to remember is counterintelligence programs include disinformation, they include provocateuring, they include gathering, they include different various operations. And so anyone who previously worked for the military is suspect as a potential operative. Whether they're active or not is irrelevant. If you've ever worked for the company, you always work for the company. Anyone who studied the CIA knows this. And that's very much the same with the NSA and some of the others. So, L. Fletcher Prouty, when he wrote his book, what does that mean? Well, remember, he had to get permission to say things before he could write it. So if it's written, there's a reason you know. So one of the reasons we don't understand who's at the top of the pyramid is because there's still a control over making sure that doesn't get published. There are journalists, however, who have attempted to tell people some of these figures near the top. Danny Casolaro, I believe, was one of these. I think the reason he was killed was because he got too close. He understood who had access to the Promise software system, and that was just too much of a threat. The Promise software was the key, the Achilles heel, if you will, to a major institution in modern-day software. They need that in secret hands. It's in the private sector somewhere. Whoever has the keys to the back door of Promise during the time had access to all global trading in real time. They had access to the bank accounts, they had access to everything. That's a serious threat, and he was trying to expose who was behind that. So, of course, he ended up killing himself, found dead in a bathtub, sure. right before he was going to publish his book. That's, I guess at the height of your career, sometimes you want to walk the plank, I guess. I don't know. Of course, you can be a conspiracy theorist like me and go for it. Here's the thing. You also have the evidence of, for example, the Bilderberg Group, which was for a long time mocked at. It was mocked at. It was laughed at. Now, in the late 90s, some documentaries came out proving these meetings do happen. And we know from just the last 10 years, there's more than just enough confirmation about these meetings. Now, these were laughed at to ever occur. Now, we still don't really understand what goes on in these meetings. We know that some of the most powerful tycoons and industrialists and bankers attend. Is it an open process? No. We don't even get it reported on. The intentional blackout in the media has got to tell you something about some control issues there. Who does not want people to know about this meeting? So is that suspect? Of course. That might be near the top of the pyramid when we're talking about players, major players near the top of the pyramid. Then you can go some of these other conspiracy theorists that I've read will get into, you know, the theory that it's just the banks and the big corporations and things like that. Could it be? Of course. You know, the banks did fund both sides of all the major wars. That's usually a good sign that they have something in common on international grounds larger than the sovereign state. That would be a suspect of somebody with some major manipulative power. Of course that's a suspect. So altogether, this is kind of the same thing. I've never seen anyone who has been able to prove beyond any reasonable doubt anybody at the very top of the pyramid, although we do have some names, some families, some bloodlines, and a few major corporate and banking interests at the top that we know are pretty near the top. I would say if we wanted to start an investigation, you'd start with these guys and you'd go down from there. You'd probably end up, you know, just like any investigator would in a crime, you'll find who you need to find if you just start with these. And we know who those are. If this country ever takes this seriously, which it looks like they're starting to, we know where to start. But again, that's a dangerous ground, too. We're seeing a lot of radicalization, 10th Amendment declarations, people that are really getting into sovereignty right now and civil liberties. This is the early signs of something that would be considered more than just revolutionary.
Before we get into that, let's go ahead and take a two-minute break. My guest is Jonathan Elenoff. You don't want to miss the next hour. Trust me, we talked a little bit off the air, and this is going to be really, really dynamite stuff. So don't go away. We'll be back in about 2 minutes with more X Squared Radio and Jonathan Elenoff.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Kentucky. Our AccuWindow forecast about 39 degrees, still raining, may head to ice along I-40. So if you're south of there, be careful. If you're north of there, be extra careful because the roads could be icy. You know, those bridges are still cold. My guest tonight, Jonathan Elinoff, his website is NewWorldOrderReport.com. I've got it written down here now. I'm not going to open the phone lines yet. The reason is Jonathan may only be with us this hour unless we can convince him that it's just too hot to leave. So hold your phone calls. We'll probably pick them up on the third hour. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back. I will stay through the third hour. So let's plan
awesome.
For that.
Awesome. All right, we'll open the phone lines in the third hour. I understand that the 2009 Bilderberger meeting was in Athens, and one guy came close to reporting, and he was going to leak the information and disappeared. I don't know what his name was, but we're about to get into a subject here that I'm sure many of you are interested in. This is not, not normally our theme that we talk about in this program. But we have been talking about cataclysms, and we have been talking about earth changes, strange energies. And one of the things that we have noticed, and you could do this just by picking up any newspaper or turning on the news yourself, is that we're at war, but we don't know with whom, and we don't know what about. We're just at war. And the interesting thing is that what we see in the public face, what we hear from our administration, what we hear from the bully pulpit, is what we think is important. And yet, this last week in Boston, the people said something else. And now the administration has gone back to its little manila envelope of instructions, and now the clarion call is jobs. We need jobs. We need jobs right away. But jobs are for the common people. Careers are for the high-level people. And if you haven't noticed lately, if you've gone to the bank and asked for money, they're not giving any away. They'll take your deposits, but they're not giving out loans. So how are they building these million-dollar, multi-million-dollar buildings in just about every small town in the country? Why is it that banks continue to grow? How can they pay back government bailout funds and then write billions of dollars in bonuses to these people in Goldman Sachs and other people who've been moving money around the planet? The reason is your money is working somewhere else. It's doing someone else's bidding. And one of the things that we're going to talk about in this hour, we talked about it briefly off the air, I promise you it is a bombshell, is Jonathan is going to, I'm going to ask Jonathan right now, what's going on in the White House? Who is Barack Obama?
Well, what we have here is, there's a few things here. The guy was groomed from an early age. There's no question about that. He's worked both for a CIA front company that defended blowback for a very long time. He's worked for Kissinger and Associates. He's worked very closely with a top-level policy writer historically in this country. It's Zbigniew Brzezinski. He's also been a member of some major think tanks. He's definitely, I would, befriended some of the most powerful interests, not just in this country, but in the world. So he definitely hung with the right crowd, if you will. So right off the bat, I knew during the campaign year, this was a guy I didn't want anyway, just because I knew who he was hanging out with. I knew we were going to have more of the same, not anything new, which wasn't a surprise. The other thing was the bringing up of his issue of his birth, where he was from. The debate is hot. It's probably one of the most heated debates out there. It's very taboo still in a lot of people's circles. My point with the birther issue, and this is largely the position I take, what people have to remember, and they have to understand this, it's not whether or not it's true. It's the reality that if that is true, that is very provocative. you can't get more provocative than that. And we can all agree, we can't all agree that we believe it or not, but we can all agree that it is widely believed and that there is a very intense debate over his citizenship, his origin, his parents' origins, all kinds of things.
Well, it's not just a debate. This week, very quietly, without fanfare, without a lot of headline, one of the cases bringing the examination of Obama's home country, his real birthright, made it to the Supreme Court. Now, one of the questions that was so carefully put together was that in 1981, Barack Obama traveled from New York to Pakistan directly. The problem is that he could not have flown under a U.S. passport because Pakistan was a no-fly area for U.S. citizens. He had to travel under one or two different passports, either British or Indonesian. And the debate is that if he was born in Kenya, he would have a British passport. But if he was born in Hawaii, he would not have had either one of those passports. He might have had an Indonesian passport because when he came to the United States to get his education, he applied under an Indonesian citizenship and was granted free passage through college. Taxpayers paid for his education because he was an Indonesian citizen. So there's a very real argument, and it's not a debate. It's going to be a legal case with real evidence, and I think the case is going to be heard by the Supreme Court. My question is, what happens if it comes out that his citizenship is decided not to be natural-born U.S.?
Well, here's my theory on this. I think that, first of all, state secrets might be used in this case. There's a good chance that Obama might have been working as an asset or agent, and if that's the case, he could have been issued any identity that they see fit. If they make this up, they can go to the judge privately, present the evidence for this, declare state secrets, and the judge has to overrule, and then it's over. Now, that I've seen this happen before with many whistleblower cases. It doesn't really matter if Obama did or didn't work for any agency. What matters is if he has friends high enough up who are willing on manufacturing that kind of a case for him. And then you're never going to know if it's true or not. Now, that's my worry, is that that probably will happen. But here's the other thing. The birth of Obama is largely, it's not given enough credit for two reasons. One is, yes, all of the birth certificates were digitalized. However, it is more than reported now, and there's two examples of this, that before 1965, Hawaii was one of the states that you could go to and have at least one American-born parent and one witness and get a birth certificate. And in at least one case of somebody who came forward did declare and said, yes, I was one of these people. In fact, it was commonly known throughout other parts of the world that if you wanted to get a citizenship, it was a little backdoor secret. Hawaii was one of the later states. And it was just kind of like a little loophole. Could that be the case? Well, remember, before 65, anyone could do that, which, of course, he's born before 65, and then, of course, all the birth certificates are digitalized. And, of course, at the end of the day, the birth certificates that have been issued go off to the hospitals for announcements. So when people talk about the announcements in the paper, I said, actually, one of the guys who came forward with his so-called Hawaii citizenship, it showed his birth announcement in the paper. He was also somebody who proved that he was from another country. So my point is there's also debates over whether or not both parents are American born if you're a citizen. That's under strict debate. But here's the thing. It's not treated. When something's not treated objectively or sympathetically, like a rational dialogue, a true intellect, that's usually my sign that somebody doesn't want any attention here. They don't.
I see a lot of talk on the floor of the House or the Senate, you know, demanding a full investigation as to whether he's a citizen or not. You're exactly right. But here's the bigger picture. Obama is largely an unknown, at least in the common political arena. He may be very well connected at high levels up, but he's unknown to the American people. He's largely unknown to the world. And it appears that he seems to be putting forth this kind of globalism mantra.
Yep.
And I would think that that flies in the face of the people that are more sovereignty-oriented.
Yes,
does
yes.
that create a conflict?
Now here's my this is also my worry. I think this guy's been groomed. I think he's been set up from the get-go. I think that the people behind him are going to push him, and they're going to use him like they use everyone else who's ever worked for him. You know, my biggest concern right now, the policy writers that are in this current administration are many of the same policy writers that were under the Clinton administration. Now, remember, the Bush policy writers were many of the Iran-Contra figures, almost all of them. All those Iran-Contra figures who created the Mujahideen in the 70s and 80s came into the Bush administration, and then we got attacked by Al-Qaeda. What a coincidence. Then you have the Clinton policy writers. Remember, the first year of Clinton was a big hype on right-wing militia groups, calling these people crazy about, oh, you talk about the New World Order, you're crazy, because Bush had just given speeches, remember, and Clinton comes in. And so the first year they were hyping up this anti-right-wing militia stuff, and then right afterwards you had Ruby Ridge, Waco, and Oklahoma City bombing right in a row. Well, what a coincidence. The policy writers came in, the propaganda began, and then convenient events happened, which a lot of people have researched that show, obviously, there's some issues with those events. Now, those policy writers are back in under Obama. Now, what did we see in the first year of Obama? Right when he got in, Southern Poverty Law Center comes out saying that if you support Ron Paul or Chuck Baldwin, you're a terrorist. We see the Mayak report. We see the Hardin, Montana case. We see, I mean, I saw it right away. I go, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, if the birds are chirping over here and the birds are flying over there and it all seems to be, if everyone's going the same direction, that's usually a sign they're getting ready for everyone else to go that direction. So they're prepping. They're priming right now. They're setting the stage. The first year is this right-wing terrorism stuff. And, you know, remember, Obama's been attributed, they've linked him to Kennedy and to Lincoln. He even was sworn in on the Lincoln Bible. He had to, he's even given speeches where he's accredited that he's like Lincoln. And there's all these, remember, assassination threats against him and talks even. People talking about, you know, he might get assassinated. What do you think is going to happen if he gets assassinated? I watched C-SPAN talk networks. I watched mainstream media discuss this. Like, it was like, oh, yeah, what do you think is going to happen if they kill him? I was like,
you're
what?
Kidding.
So I'm very concerned with an event, possibly an attempt on the president's life or a successful assassination. And I wouldn't be surprised if we hear that it's, and this is what they'll tell us, they might say it's a birther, somebody who's sovereignty-stricken, a civil liberties guy, and they'll spin it. They'll say this guy's anti-world progress. He believes in conspiracy theories about world government and that Obama's pushing it, and he's just anti-progress, this guy. Now, the reason why I'm worried about this is because Obama really is loved around the world. American presidents haven't really had that ability. And he's also pushing pretty hard in his speeches. So I wouldn't be surprised if right around the time Obama starts giving these speeches about, you know, his vision for world citizenship and world government and yada, 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 that, you know, there's an attempt on his life or something, and it's either in a convenient situation that's probably a framed job or a made-up job or some Manchurian candidate stuff. And they try to turn the sovereignty movement into the aggressor. And people, what they have to understand is the reason why they would do this is because the biggest threat to a world government agenda would be somebody who is sovereignty stricken, is civil right. liberties.
Highly nationalized, like an ultra-patriot coming forward and saying, you know, we're not going to give up our U.S. sovereignty for some, you know, blue-helmeted U.N.-backed government coming in here and changing our constitution like it hasn't already been changed. Mm-hmm. My question is, Obama's a smart guy. He's got to know that he is being put in a sling here. If they're openly talking about a conflict that is nigh unto martyrdom to create a global groundswell for a movement that really doesn't have any support in this country. This is really earth-shaking stuff here. Is this what we're talking about? A martyrdom event?
Yes. If you want to martyr the cause of globalism, that's what you would want to do. Somebody who's revered around the world, who's loved, is Obama. He's hated here. But then again, you know, I can see this now where he gives these speeches about his ideal for world government or whatever, and then he's killed. They show the aggressor to be some sovereignty-stricken American patriot, and forever they show that person that he's an aggressor. He's anti-progress. He's just anti-peace, really. That's how they'll spin it. And the reason why I'm worried about this is obviously because of the links between Lincoln and Obama, his pushes for that, and the publicity of this birther stuff that has gotten, and the level of credibility it might have. That's direct, man. I've studied these guys my whole life. I know the people in power. I've met some of them. Some of them have admitted things to me in confidence. What worries me is they're not stupid. They're very smart. If they want something to get that much press, which believe me, that there's nothing that has gotten more than the birther issue, there's a reason. You can't get more provocative to a revolutionary intervention, if you will, than that. If there was an attempt on the president's life, nobody would believe a conspiracy. Nobody would consider it. Why? The guy is pretty much not from this country, and there's people who believe that. Doesn't matter if I believe it, doesn't matter if you believe it. We all know there's people who believe it. Would anyone question a conspiracy? No. It makes you wonder why it got so much attention. It also makes you wonder why, for example, look at the people walking up and shaking his hand. What is this? I mean, I know planted stories when I see them. Okay, I study the news. These are planted stories. This was the first president we had to increase security. We had to increase private security for him because of the death threats. Remember all the talk of death threats against him? There were preachers praying for this guy to die. I remember the reports. And all of a sudden people are walking and shaking his hand. Yeah, bull crap. I know a planted story when I see one. And you know what that is? That's prepping. They are priming and setting the stage. They're setting the course. Because whatever they're going to do with this guy, they could have a sacrifice to their gods. That's how these sick sociopaths do it in the upper echelons. They believe in this stuff. And they martyr their interests. They're going to turn their enemies into the aggressor.
Does Obama know what's about to happen? Is he willing to go along with it? Is he going to take a bullet? I mean, is he...
First of all, there's the possibility that he doesn't know. Second of all, there's the possibility that anything can be staged today. You know this as well as I do. Could it just be an attempt on his life that they're going to try that and see if it does it, whether it's successful or not? Could it be successful in assassination? But you have to remember, the guy is born in 63. What's going on in 63? The CIA is doing a lot of things. I don't know if you know this, but I'm sure you do, but, you know, cloning has been around since, like, the early 1900s, and anyone who's studied top-secret black, you know, ops knows that we've been, down in Dulce and a few other places, we've been doing some things, genetic modification, for a pretty long time. I've traveled, by the way, down there. I know what goes on there. I don't know. I'm speculating here. I'm just saying. There's a million possibilities here for when the event happens, if it's real, if it's not, if it's a stand-in, if whatever. If he really knows it, if he doesn't know it, who knows? He might not know anything. You know, these guys do get groomed at a young age, and they're brainwashed, you know, Manchurian candidate style. Who knows what Obama knows? But I'll tell you this, if he's hearing this, and I hope he does, come out and talk now, buddy. Clear yourself. Clear now. Come out clean, because this is your only hope, man. I can see this coming a mile away, and I don't know why nobody else can, because I can see this coming a mile away. And these planted stories of these people going up and shaking his hand, what I love about this, I'm OCD and I think in synchronicity a lot. I know if there's an attempt on the president's life, you mark my words, when it happens, that day, every journalist and anchor is going to go, well, you know, those people went up and shook his hand so many times, maybe we need to increase security in this country. And then just like that, boom, anti-terror legislation passes. You can no longer say any free. You can't even wear buttons when you're in the presence of a politician. The federal funding for all politicians protected now. Think about the things they could pass on an attempt on the president's life on that. You know, the screening of people who attend campaign speeches, all kinds of things. But I think this is, remember, what are the policy writers talking about right now? What is the first year of Obama's administration? Remember, it's all about right-wing militias. It's about psychological issues with how can we detect terrorism before it happens. This is scary talk, man. They want an event, and they're going to provoke one. If they can't get one, then there's going to be one some other way. That's their history. That's what they had with Ruby Ridge, remember. They talked it up for a year, and then they tried to provoke an event. Remember, those militias were outside. They couldn't do anything, and they kept their cool, and I have a lot of respect for those militias. But what happened? They even shot the guy's wife, man. They brought out those shirts. Have you ever seen those clips?
No, I haven't.
Lon Huriucci, that traitor. But here's the reality. After Ruby Ridge, you have Waco, where Huriucci was down there as well, and then you also have Oklahoma City bombing. And those were all very convenient situations, not just provocations, but you have active interest in trying to destroy the Patriot movement. And right in the first year of Obama, we have the same thing.
It was mid last year, I think it was, that Obama passed Emergency Powers Act over the Internet. And this is a guy that raised $600 million through social networking on the Internet, and now he has emergency powers over the Internet. He can actually take control, worse than China, and shut it down. I know that there's Internet monitoring going on, that they want to track. There's like 500 threats a day on the Pentagon, on the Internet, and now they're trying to track it. I know... One of my friends, who I used to go motorcycle riding with, and I'm not going to mention his name, but he works in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. You know, I brag about having a 6 megabyte internet connection. He has a 2 gig internet connection. And I said, why in the world would you need an internet connection that fast? I mean, that changes screens before you hit the enter key. He said, my office monitors emails.
Interesting.
Every single email that goes on the web goes through a lexicon, and certain words are pulled out of those emails, and by statistics, like little pachinko balls, they fall down into what he calls a fast Fourier transform analysis, and it calculates the odds that you would use certain words, and once those words show up, your email address and your IP address, that means when you take your laptop, for instance, from Kentucky and you go to California and you log in at the DoubleTree Hotel, your laptop is the same laptop that was used in Kentucky. You're going to come up on that system. And if you write another email that has the same words in it, the tracking is increased on you. And before too long, you could disappear. You could be picked up.
Right, that's right. And you know, we know Echelon was declassified in the 90s, but the main core system is one of the most powerful logging systems, and there's a few others. That stuff's been around for a long time. I have software that I've purchased before just out of curiosity to be able to have access to somebody's cell phone for just a few seconds, and then I can forever access their text messages, turn their phone on like a microphone. I've tampered and played with that technology before, just because I'm a private investigator for hire as well, and it's very valuable stuff. It's amazing what's out there right now. The technology is people should know everything's being monitored and watched. We should know that already. But as long as you're not doing anything illegal, you have nothing to worry about.
That's
this was a good point today. I forgot to mention this. You know, who's to say Obama wouldn't want to be a martyr? You know, these guys, if you're going to do something enough that you're going to live for it, then you're going to die for it, right? I mean, everybody has their fears. But I know a lot of people who do what they love, and they wouldn't care if they died tomorrow because they do what they love.
Mm.
Who's to say Obama wouldn't want to be a martyr, man? What if he's so obsessed with this idea? What if they've really messed his head up, man? Remember, he was under Kissinger and Brzezinski his whole life. Who knows what they were telling him? You know, there's advanced psychological warfare machines and programs that we can use on people to do things, to make them think things, to make them do whatever we want them to do, essentially, and have the outcome that we wish. And that includes their entire mindset, their entire belief system. There's some of the studies that came out of the 70s and 80s we know now. You can actually completely not just manipulate someone's paradigm, but create it You can create, I mean, it's the stuff that they know in the Pentagon is just very dangerous. Who knows what they, what Obama could be? This guy was born pretty recently. He could be the first, you know, 2.0 or whatever. Some people are calling him the 2.0. Who knows? He could be a real, you know, I don't know. But my point is, seeing that he's loved around the world as he is and hated here, and that he is pushing, this administration is pushing harder than we've ever seen for world government and things along that agenda, that makes me wonder if this is all intentionally set up, and that's why some of these people behind the scenes, they get off on this stuff. They love it. They crack up and they like it when they slip in the Lincoln Bible and they tell a speechwriter, hey, tell him to say that he thinks of himself as Lincoln. And they sit back and they watch on TV and they get a giggle. You know, I who knows? You know, these guys are like to crack themselves up with symbolism and synchronicity, and there's nothing more with Obama than that. So I'm very concerned.
Remember Bush giving his speech about uniting the world, and he had all this Atlantean symbolism and the circle with the blue circle with the canals, and everything is all done in lights and everything, and even the verbiage that he used was very, you know, Lemurian in how it was put together. Just really strange Freemason kind of overtones to everything. A couple of observations. One is I noticed on Drudge Report the last, three or four days, since the Bostonian Tea Party election that they had, where the candidate won by an astounding 6% in a market that has, for 50 years, been controlled by liberal Democrats, they show pictures of Obama with a frown on his face, and the byline is, "The thrill is gone." And the other is, there's big talk, very common talk right now, that Obama might be a one-termer. And you can't get your agenda done in 4 years. It's just not possible in Washington. You need at least one cycle of senators to go through you. And if he only lasts one term, there has to be another way for him to accomplish his agenda. That's the observation that I made.
Right, that is true. I did see a report. One of the reasons why there was such a support in the administration for more war was because that helps increase your statistics for having a two-term situation. If you're a wartime president, hopefully with a more increased conflict, people tend to stay with the president in power, especially since they control wartime propaganda. They can report successes right around election time. We saw that under Bush. One of the reasons we probably have the increase in the war is for that. You know, they're going to dilly-daddle around, and then they might pull that card out as a wild card. Let's see how effective it is. The people are waking up to this. It's taking a while for people to figure out the game of politics. Fairly simple game. Just read Edward Bernays' Propaganda. But the people don't understand this is all a game. Politics is a very simple game. Mass mind control, mass media manipulation, and it goes back. It's been studied probably more than anything else. It's one of the things we know the least about, which is the mind, but it's also one of the things that's some of the information we know about it is pretty dangerous. And I think that there's an interest right now to basically this left-right paradigm is seems to be working, and this is my, I have a new film coming out called The Mad Divide. The Mad Divide is going to attempt to, it's a call to intellectuals to say, you know, look, it's been enough presidents now from the Republicans and Democrats that I think it's fair to say anyone who's really paying attention knows the policy is not being decided either by the party platform or by the people in the party or the people of the United States. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's not an opinion. It's just fact. And that's kind of what my issue is with Republicans and Democrats is I'm very concerned with the parties being completely taken over. Now, we did notice with the Campaign for Liberty that we had very liberty-stricken people and true constitutionalists join the Republican Party. That was a refreshing experience. However, they still do not control the party position, the major
yeah, that's
body
right.
hierarchy. So although they are...
That people notice is that it doesn't matter who's in office. It seems like everything is going forward just like it always does. Now, if you ever go to Washington, and I do from time to time because of my industry, what you notice is that Washington, we really don't have a government. What we have is a loose coalition of bureaucracies that seem to manage the same checkbook. And when it gets out of balance, then they go to the politicians and say, you've got to find us more money. We need more money. And the bureaucrats, their name never gets in the paper. The cabinet does. Secretary Chu's name gets in there. But you never hear, you know, of Coozer. You never hear of Conley. You never hear of these guys that are in the Department of Energy that really make the decisions on where and who gets in the game and where the money goes and all of that, because they survive president after president after president, and their agendas largely don't change regardless of what the president says.
Right, and that was the same thing with Brzezinski and Kissinger. They've been in almost every administration since they entered Washington, but nobody talks about them. There's figures in the administrations that have rotated chairs for a very long time. They keep coming back. Policy writers are very much the same. Same with speech writers. A lot of them are the same. But again, the way they get people not to pay attention to this stuff is by throwing social politics in the people's face. This is what I found out when I did my research for the Mad Divide. The origin of this country is that we never had social politics in common. We didn't have them in common then. This country couldn't agree on multiple wives, marrying cousins, slavery, to which god they worshipped. I mean, you want to talk about social politics, they couldn't agree on them. They didn't. But what they could agree on was they stood together against England, against the king. They stood together in their pursuit of liberty and their pursuit of private property ownership and the declaration of how they want to live their lives. And what they all agreed on is that we should protect everyone's right to pursue their own life. That's what they agreed on. Not declare on everyone what that life is, but the protection of any life that you want to pursue, as long as it doesn't infringe on a few minor ideas. They didn't really like the idea of the federal government very much because they didn't like centralized power. But they didn't like the idea of centralized power in the private sector very much either. There were bank charter limitations. There were corporate charter limitations. Everything had limitations. See, over the time, though,
still,
you have this...
Still, Hamilton pushing for a national bank, and it was defeated at every turn. And now,
right.
If you get a federal loan guarantee or a federal loan, a direct loan, you get it from a national bank. You get it from the U.S. bank, the government's bank. We might not think that there's a national bank, but there is one. And I don't know if it's bankrupt or not, because the local banks, the actual ground-level banks, aren't getting any money.
Right.
There's no building going on. Oh, there's lots of road building going on. But I can tell you right now, two indicators we look at in our industry, we look at cardboard, corrugated, and we look at titanium dioxide. Why? Because those are the base elements for paint and packaging. If nothing's getting painted, then titanium dioxide sales will be down. If nothing's getting packaged, then cardboard sales will be down. They're at an all-time low. Nothing is going on. No capital is making its way to industry.
Right. Yeah, it's a vacuum right now. And the ripples are going to hit pretty hard. There'll be a second wave and a third wave. I've been telling people about this for a while. I'm one of the people who was for a very long time warning people of the coming collapse. I'm also still telling people there will be a second wave, so better learn about the economy sooner or later. I'm glad you know about it.
The strange thing is, though, there's lots of people ready to go to work. There's lots of industry.
Oh yeah.
Ready to be
there's
done.
There's no lack of workers. There's no drought in the sense of the And here's what's really unfortunate about what's going on. It's so obvious that they're trying to create the vacuum, because it's obvious we have a lot of people demanding jobs. It's obvious there's a lot of interest in work. It's not hard to find people that want to work. And it's also, we're dealing with, it's not like there's a lack of money in that sense.
No, there's plenty of customers.
Right.
My goodness, everything we could make for the next 2 years is already sold.
Right.
But you can't get the capital to buy the raw materials.
Well, they're not loaning it. Nobody's loaning.
Exactly. Exactly.
And the people with money aren't they're sitting on it. Well, I think a lot of them are playing some other games, but you know, it's a vacuum right now. They're going to eat each other up. That's what happens in this time of the market. It's a scary time.
It's doing the mega rich, and I'm going to say these are people with $100 million or more net worth. They're doing the same thing the banks are doing. They're trading currencies. They're not loaning money. They're not investing money.
No, yeah. I don't think anyone's loaning
currencies. They're making 40-50% on their money out there.
Right.
Why would they ever invest in a business where they only make 10 or 12%?
This was a point I wanted to make, was one of the things that people have to remember in this country is that statehood means a sovereign entity. It's the state of Israel, you see. Statehood, the reason they called it the United States was because it was a radical idea at that time where we would have separate sovereign entities coming together, forming a common interest, a common cause, a constitution. It was a new idea at that time in the 1770s, something that you wouldn't find too often on the planet. It's probably one of the first. But here's the interesting thing. The reason that they decided separate sovereign entities was because not just the separation of powers, but actually because social politics weren't agreed upon. They really believed in private property ownership, and that the people who owned the property in a town get to write the laws of that town, and then the people who own the property in a state, they get to influence the state, and so on and so forth. They really believed in people's pursuit of their liberty. They didn't care what you wanted to do.
And the original setup was that the state legislators would send senators to Washington. We didn't have elected senators. They were appointed by the legislations of the states. Now we have senators that are running for office, and they don't do so just in their own states. They run national campaigns.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The effect senators have is they sit on, for example, security councils and you know, all kinds of commissions and things. They play major roles in society beyond their state level. But this is one of the things I found interesting, was that for a very long time they warned against a two-party system. The framers were very much conscious of social politics becoming an issue because they knew that nobody agreed on them then. They never agreed on them in this country. When we started to see social politics becoming an issue, there was a transition. This country used to be it used to be an etiquette with debate. It used to be rational dialogue and discussion. You used to be able to turn on the TV and see rational, you know, interviews. Now you turn it on and you see, like, it's a joke. Okay, there's name-calling. People are telling each other to shut up. This is not news. This is a talk show with a guest and an opinion. This guy's paid to have an opinion. He has his legal right to lie if he wants to. So what people think when they say, oh, well, the news is lying, actually, they usually don't watch the news. They don't watch 60 Minutes. They don't watch investigative reporting. They're not watching actual news, like headline news. They're watching a talk show. They're thinking of O'Reilly or Olbermann, Maddow, Hannity. These are talk shows. This is not news. So one of the things, one of the very smart breakdowns in this country was being able to detach people from news, turn them onto talk shows, and then separate them, get them in touch and angry with their social politics, something that the framers said, no, don't declare this on everyone, just respect everyone's social politics. When we run on the federal level, the president is not decided on social politics. Social politics are for your local and state governments. The president's job is to deal with foreign policy, economic policy,
yeah.
War.
Yeah, that's right.
And what's funny, isn't it funny how you don't hear about those every election? Well, why is that? Well, because if you did, well, boy, you'd just realize that you don't have any effect on the president. He doesn't work for you because those policies aren't written by you. So they can't have people paying attention to things on the federal level, so they know that if they throw social politics in people's face, they know we're divided on that. We've never agreed on those. So one of the oldest games in the book is using social politics. And it's insulting what the framers intended. And by the way, I'm not saying that Republicans or Democrats are wrong. Social politics are not fake. It's that they have no place on the federal. That's not how you decide your president. So
right.
That wasn't what the framers intended. So we need a call for this country to reawaken and stop supporting the criminal syndicates of the Republicans and Democrats, because they don't work for us. I feel very happy and you know, I'm in support of the Campaign for Liberty. I like how the, what they're doing, but they are still going into a party largely that is not for those interests. The party there are official party positions. One of the things I did in the Mad Divide was we did a census. We did a street census. We took polls, and we found out that most people, when we asked them their positions, what do you feel about this? What do you respond? We give them multiple choice. Based on their answers, the majority of people, first of all, don't know the positions of their party. The second thing we found, the second trend we found, was the majority of people are in the wrong party. According to their issues, they should be into these other parties like libertarians.
That's right. Yeah, I see that all the time.
So I found that to be very interesting. and it's not just that they're in the wrong party. It's that people do recognize that they want to vote their conscience, but they're scared to. They're told that, oh, their vote's not going to matter. Their vote's going to be thrown away. Well, that's a very advanced psychological warfare tactic to convince somebody that their vote didn't count as a vote. that's advanced psychological warfare.
Well, hopefully the election in Boston, you know, woke people up. Here was a liberal stronghold. I mean, the Kennedys have controlled this since the earth cooled.
Right.
And here you have a guy who didn't clandestinely, he openly campaigned that he would not support Obama's health care plan. And in the middle, in their own backyard, he was elected by a virtual landslide. So hopefully the rest of the nation looks at this and people are talking it up enough where even in areas like, oh, here in eastern Kentucky, where we're completely estranged from the governor of our state, for instance, roads that had already been surveyed, already a third of the money had been spent. All of a sudden the budget is just evacuated, just scooped out and given to pet projects of the governor. So he's lost the eastern side of eastern part of the state of Kentucky, and there's large talk now of him being a one-term governor. He doesn't like it, but that's the results of those kinds of activities. Mm-hmm. What we often talk about on this program, even though we don't get into conspiracy theories, we do talk about sovereignty and personal responsibility.
Excellent.
And I try to explain to people that almost every single town in America is larger than Congress. There's only 435 of those guys up there. And what would it hurt to just change them all out? Change everybody out. Run for
right.
office and change everyone.
It wasn't there also a direct proportion when we decided that 435, it was based on proportions. Those haven't been adjusted in a long time. If we had a correctly proportioned society, those wouldn't be there. What I like about the United States is that it's a cross between a republic and a democracy. It's by definition a democratic republic. We do appoint representatives to make our decisions, but they tend to vote in a democratic process. One of the things that people misunderstand about our country is that, first of all, democracy and republic both mean the same thing. They mean the people. One's Latin and one's Greek. But the idea that the framers all agreed on was that the representatives are to be they're supposed to represent their constituents, which are the people. What we lost in this country was just that. We don't have representatives 9 times out of 10 that are working for us. Who are the constituents of the people in Congress passing the bailout? Well, that's not us, because the people overwhelmingly didn't support it. Well, if we overwhelmingly didn't support it, then how did it get passed? And this is what I'm talking about. If you look at the decisions made both in Congress and Senate and by the president, it's clear that they're not working for us. So you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to realize there are other interests that are manipulating policy. The question is, what are they and who are they? And one of the things we have to realize is there's a long time history of the two parties, Republican and Democratic, both those parties being infiltrated, co-opted, and controlled to prevent them from being real representatives. Now, Ron Paul was one of my favorites. He has reformed the Republican Party. Well, he's begun to reform the Republican Party. He's brought the party back to the Constitution and to liberty and to what it really originally meant to be a Republican, and I think it's a beautiful thing. Hopefully, and now we're seeing more and more people follow that trend. We need that to continue, and that by the way, that campaign for liberty doesn't need to just end in, you know, the Republican Party. Democrats should embrace this as well. This is something, you know, liberty is something that actually has something to do with being very liberal. Libertarian Party tends to be a centrist party by definition. They generally support everything because the whole idea is the pursuit of protecting everyone's right to do whatever they want, whether it's own a gun or have an abortion or whatever. They just kind of respect people's place because we all share in our liberty. That's why it's a centrist party. So some people call it the ultra-right because it supports gun rights. Some people call it the ultra-left because it's technically in support of abortion. But what it's really in support of is states' rights. It's really in support of, well, whatever you want, you should really have. The government's job is just to be neutral and to protect your pursuit of liberty. It's your job to figure out what you want in your state and your local town. And they don't like social politics on the federal level. So Ron Paul, who was a libertarian going into the Republican Party, was a very clever move because he was able to get a lot of attention to the libertarian issue. And now we're starting to see a lot of both Republicans and Democrats awaken to the idea of liberty yet again. And this beautiful country will come back to that awakening of sovereignty and liberty. But like we just talked about with Obama and this current globalization, I think we need to be very careful, because while this liberty awakening is happening, I'm very concerned with, we're not the only ones who see this coming. I think they see this and they're very worried about that. That's just why they're rushing the agenda so quickly. So we have to be aware of events when they happen, condemn any acts of violence if they happen. Hopefully they won't. But again, you know, hey, if there was an attempt on the president's life coming up, I'll tell you right now, everyone's going to be downloading this radio show a million times, because they're going to go, how did these guys know? And they're going to listen to us and they're going to go, oh my gosh, they're right. So if they want to martyr my cause, please go ahead. But, you know, we'll see. You know, you want to make change, and the way you do it is by speaking peace. That's how you do it, man. You go out there and you let the truth set you free. And it's this old idea where you just tell people, trust that they're going to believe you, and you project that, and hopefully you'll manifest that. And I think people do believe us. As long as you're credible, as long as you know what you're talking about, you seem to know what you're talking about. I'm trying to do it with some more taboo topics, but again, I think it's becoming more popular. There's a trend coming that's getting into some of these things that I'm into. But you know, we all share in our respect for each other's liberty and our protection of that. So my call in the Mad Divide is really this issue of, will we see third-party candidates running for president where we see real petitions and real representatives, whether they go into the Republican and Democratic Party or not, isn't so much my issue. The question is, are we going to get our country back? Are we going to get representatives again? And I really do think that's coming. I think there's enough people that are upset right now. There's more people upset with government now. It's almost, and I wasn't around during the 60s, but I have a lot of older friends who tell me that it reminds them of the 60s right now.
Well, it does in a way, because there was this kind of clarion call about communism, and the Cold War was just winding up. I mean, a lot of people were pouring a lot of money into it. It was an unbelievable, almost uncontrollable economy. The government just couldn't get a handle on it. It was moving so fast. There was so much free enterprise happening. There was so much investment happening. It was kind of like the Roaring Twenties, almost. You couldn't do any wrong. Anything that Detroit built and hit the docks sold, and largely it was junk. And these were cars that were made to go and not stop. And if you got in an accident with them, you were going to die. I mean, there was a lap belt, no airbags, no roll cages, and 500 horsepower under the hood. And you were really lucky if you got 100,000 miles out of a vehicle. And industry was like that everywhere. I don't care if you bought a toaster or if you bought a handsaw. Quality was junk, but everything was going off the shelves as fast as it could go. What is the difference between then and now? The difference is, people would say, globalism, that we no longer have a local market. We don't have a local manufacturer.
International corporations and international trading agreements have destroyed a lot of that.
Yeah, when we do business with, when we buy a Toyota, for instance, the money doesn't stay in the United States. It goes to Japan. They're really, you know, when you look at small pickup trucks in America, they're only 68% American. the rest of them are built overseas. And I mean, if you buy a Chevy, it's 32% foreign made. If you buy a Harley Davidson, almost all the parts are made in China. It's an American bike, but the parts are made in China. It's still the most expensive bike on the market, I think. But and you know, quality still isn't there. But that's what we're talking about. The money isn't staying at home. We see a middle class struggling. We see an upper class, a billionaire class of people, not moving their capital in this country. We have billionaires who are investing in electric cars in Norway, in China, in India, but they're not investing in the United States. Why? Why is the United States not a good investment right now?
Well, that's going to be a question for an economic expert, but it's my understanding from the people that I've studied, we're pretty much going to go down. The interest is kind of just to leave us in the dust. A lot of people kind of, the dream is over, prosperity in America is over, and they're starting to realize that, and they're starting to see that a lot of the people who made all the wealth here took their accounts and went overseas, and the money's leaving the country. You know, it's not staying here. Why keep your money here when you have enough money just to go buy a mansion out and, you know, where you want to live? You know, people are getting mansions and all, like three or four of them all over the world. And they're on a global scale. They think on a global scale. And even raw produce and industry is like this. We're so interdependent on our food supplies, it's not even funny. We're also completely interdependent on our raw materials. I saw a report that said that oil will be, you know, sold from Saudi Arabia to China, and then China will largely produce small parts, oil and plastics and stuff that'll be sent over to the United States to be reassembled and then sent back, put inside of a phone, and then put back, sent over. And then, I mean, some of the stuff that I've seen, people show the amount of transportation for this before it hits the market. We're so interdependent. It's a global system, and that's why world government is probably not just going to succeed, but it's logical to these guys because it's already already operating on a global sphere. The business and banking was international.
We'll discuss it more in the next hour because that's what I want to talk about. Is this global economy, how it relates to the United Nations, and who's going to get left behind? We'll be back with more X Squared Radio in about 4 minutes. Don't go away. Welcome back. X Squared Radio, third hour. My guest tonight, Jonathan Elinoff. His website, newworldorderreport.com. If you want to catch up on more of this information, that is where you go. I wanted to bring this up. The space or jurisdiction in which the UN operates and derives its formal authority is the law of admiralty or maritime law. All its institutions and structures also operate in this space. The problem is that this law is a mercantile, private legal space. The UN is a private corporate enterprise. This position places severe limitations on the way the UN can relate to the world around it, and there is no flexibility in the system. For example, the current international system. It is actually designed to incorporate, to bind, not only nations, but individuals by usurping the natural legal space in which we were meant to operate. This is a corporatocracy, from John Perkins. This is what is hiding behind the agendas for democracy, environment, peace, human rights, etc. For the UN to have power, for example, US and a few other nations, all other jurisdictions and legal systems must submit to the admiral jurisdiction under which the UN operates. The money elite want to globalize for their good reasons. The traditional nation-state will always seek to accumulate power and monopolize it. There is no gain in state power without the exact same loss of social power. There is an absolute connection and the legal framework into which it is represented. This means when changing the monetary system, the legal framework must also be changed. For example, new international law operating in a universal jurisdiction. That means right here in the United States as well. What is law? It defines our very existence. You may operate within the law of attraction or in a state of chaos and anarchy. It is of little consequence if the state of the political monetarism does not operate in harmony with a certain legal state. That legal state becomes of no social consequence. That is why the spiritual law does not come into its full potential, except maybe for individuals that retreat from society and seek solace, like here in Eastern Kentucky. In our world, this is not an option. It should be our first duty to change the state of political monetarism in order to pave the way to a legal system that fully recognizes the individual, not as a subject, but as a sovereign. And that's where I want to open up this hour. We're talking about the control that the White House seems to have over things is largely a facade. It's largely a charade. The real control takes place behind the scenes. And maybe the real control happens in that building we call the UN. What do you think, Jonathan?
I think the UN is a governing body that is largely being manipulated by the same entity that is controlling the White House. I wouldn't say without any certainty that it's the UN behind the White House. I would say it's the same people behind the UN that are behind the White House. And I would say the same thing with behind a lot of other governments and other institutions, certain corporate interests as well are in there, but there's also banks. There are common names and there are common people with an agenda that they all agree upon that are behind it together. But the UN was put forth by many of the same people who I think co-opted control of this country. And there's a history to that. There's a relationship between, for example, the Round Table Network and World War One. There's a relationship between the Round Table Network and the Federal Reserve. And then there's a relationship with the people behind the Round Table Network and then that turned out to be the Council on Foreign Relations. And those same people behind World War II, manipulating both sides and, of course, setting up the UN. So there is a theme and a history to it that has to be understood for, you know, its place. And not everyone understands that period of time because it's not really taught in our schools with all of the facts. It's not necessarily that we're lied to, it's that they just don't tell us the whole thing. They withhold information. And so it's not, one of the things that I've noticed is education in this country has intentionally been manipulated with, because to gain where they need to go, they have to destroy what people know. We saw this with the destruction of, look at the origin of this country. People don't know about the Continental Congress and the presidents before Washington. And why do you think that is? Well, one of the reasons, obviously, is if they did know about those, they'd realize central banking was a serious issue during the fight for this country.
You bet.
So it's no coincidence it's not in our schools, because if it was, we'd say, wait a second, we're going against what the framers wanted.
Yeah, every time you take a local bank or a state bank with 30 or 40 or 50 branches and it's bought by a national bank, like, say, Chase or Morgan Stanley or Bank of America, you move closer and closer to that national bank level. And I can tell you, I've dealt with both. I've dealt with the national banks. I've dealt with the local bank. I kind of like being called Brooks when I walk in the door instead of 212-1404. And when I call in to someone to get help with my bank account, all I have to do is give them my name and, oh, yes, how are you doing? Yes, I'm doing fine. But if I call into the national banks, I get, for English, press 1. And I think most people are getting a little tired of it. We're not local anymore in our business. And I don't know if it's a good thing or if it's a bad thing, but this globalism, this new world order that is taking place, on the one hand, people have a natural phobia against it because we look at leaders like Chavez or we look at Putin or we look at our own president and we say to ourselves, would we want them in control of the world? The answer, irrefutably, no, from all points. Even the upper echelon of people would say, no, we wouldn't want that. But I can go right down here to the local Baptist church and ask them if they thought it was a good idea if Jesus ran the world. And I guarantee I'd get an amen on it. It would depend on who the leader was. But just like in feudalism in the Middle Ages, when you had a good king, things were very good. But when his son rose to power, then you had war and you had despotism.
Right.
So how do we fix it? How do we become a global economy looking to space?
Well, this is something that I want to refer to H.G. Wells, former head of the MI5, major player in the Roundtable Network and one of the architects of where we are today. He wrote a book that came out in 1940 called New World Order. Now, there's a reason why most people have not read this book. It's not because it's not widely available. It's because of what's inside it. His description, and it's one of the first of the terminology New World Order where it was publicly disclosed, one of the first doctrines publicly disclosed, his description is beyond shocking. When I read that, I, first of all, realized something that was a little disturbing, but a little entertaining at the same time. And that is that this might be beyond where people can conceptually conceive sometimes how intelligence and morality have absolutely nothing in common. Intelligence means one thing. If you really want to achieve world government, you achieve it the same way you achieve any other government. And how is that? Through revolution.
Right.
One of the things that these people specialize in, and when I say these people, I'm talking about the people who, the origin of a lot of this. One of the things they specialized in was revolutions. The French Revolution, the American Revolution, and so on and so forth. And right in the opening of the book, H.G. Wells gives credit to his predecessors, saying that is how we've always been able to achieve a stable government, is by making sure it has a noble cause, getting the people behind it. Well, how do you ignite the people to bring forth your agenda? without them knowing it. One of the oldest motivating factors, and he says this in the book, and this is why it's very shocking, he says, sovereignty and civil liberties are some of the most igniting factors getting somebody motivated. He said that, see, if we have world government and it's perceived as world peace, it has to be fought for through those causes against a global threat to those issues. And much like the United States, where you had national sovereignty declared between separate sovereign states, is kind of what he was suggesting a world government, an efficient world government, would be separate nation states declared in a common theme. Now, if he is saying that that is what the New World Order is, then that is beyond ingenious, and it's something that most people have never thought about when we talk about above and beyond the manipulation, beyond the money interests. We're talking now about before the money even was money. We're talking about people who had just ideas meeting in lodges in secret, discussing how are we really going to see this through. Something that they thought through beyond what people can conceive. Maybe they know something's going to crash down, even if they know it'll be resisted and fought against, because there's only one way to establish a government. Doesn't matter if it's good or bad. They just want that government. That's something they want. It's something we don't like to digest thinking about, because the ethical question of how to obtain it comes into play. But then again, we're not talking about ethics. We're talking about intelligence. We're talking about, can you figure out a way to do it? Read the book, New World Order.
The difference between intelligence, I guess, and peace is that you can also have a mad scientist. You can have an insane
Absolutely.
Leader who is brilliant. And he can use, for instance, the ability to globally tax or to globally manipulate currency. So, like the businesses in the United States that cannot gain access to capital right now because the government will not give them grants, will not give them loans, won't give them loan guarantees, and the banks aren't loaning to anyone. No one. Only people that have pristine credit, and that's only because the law is forcing them to do it. The same thing would happen on a global scale, only now, instead of talking about small businesses trying to gain access to capital, you're talking about countries trying to do things like put in a dam to create electricity for their people. They can't get the capital because the global government is controlling it and
right.
forcing capital into the megacities where they control the most votes, and they control the armies, and they control the flow of natural resources such as oil and even electricity.
Now, one of the things to remember is if they continue on the path that they're on, they're going to achieve world government because, let's face it, that's what they're doing. This model of boom bust and sucking and the economy the way that it works right now. Then you have the possibility, the contingency, what if it fails? Let's talk about that. What if that does fail? What'll happen? Large resistance movements with leaders. Sounds a lot like something someone else specializes in. So what my point was is, if you read New World Order, what he says is, we will not have world peace, but we will have world order. And you achieve it, whether you like it or not, you're going to achieve it through incrementalism or resistance. But we're going to lead which one we choose, because both will lead us to where we want to go. And it's disturbing, it's shocking, but he's right. He's unfortunately right, and there's a reason why a lot of people have never read that book. Because if they have, they'd say, my gosh, that means that they might have planned a contingency. Of course they did. They don't plan. They don't specialize in black ops and pay Pentagon workers, you know, the money that they do to think of, you know, contingencies that don't happen all the time. These guys have a rap sheet. They know how to prepare for things. My point is, for example, like with 9/11, people talk about a conspiracy with 9/11. If that's true, you have to bear in mind, if they're that smart to plan that, then I'll tell you this, given their rap sheet, you have to also know they planned for people to find out. What does that tell you? That tells you that they're not just going to have people in the movement talking about it. They might just have the very first ones talking about it. It's not about...
Yeah, exactly right.
So it's not necessarily about right or wrong. These guys are sociopaths. It's about making sure you control everything on all aspects. And some people don't always understand what that really means. That includes controlling the resistance and the revolution. But what would a revolution do to world threat, a world government, a world new world order? What would a revolution to that be? It would be multiple nation states coming together with probably leaders saying, you know, we can't ever let this happen again. But we don't want to go backwards. So we need to have some kind of international setup. But we want to respect each other's sovereignty because we don't want to see this again. Aha. At that time, you're going to see creativity and imagination come about, and you will probably see what may have been intended from the very beginning. To get people to do that from the very beginning, sometimes you have to play a game on them.
Yeah,
knowing
yeah,
that game
you're
going
to have to make a wholesale move. You know, one of my listeners writes in and says, wait till all your money will be stored on your microchip, and there won't be any real money anymore. If this goes through, all work, supply, financial abilities of the individuals will be controlled. Mm-hmm. One of the things that strikes true about that, and it'll be so easy to sell, is they could just say, well, the only way to win the war on drugs is to take cash out of the market. Because all these rogue states, all these weapon systems, all these terrorists are being funded by cash that's floating through the system. You know, blood diamonds, et cetera, et cetera. So you control all the cash electronically, and then you can stop any kind of large revolution that can happen. But revolutions might occur on a local scale. You know, there's a quote by Jose Ortega, 1922, actually. It says, this is the gravest danger that today threatens civilization, state intervention, the absorption of all spontaneous social efforts by the state. That is to say, of spontaneous historical action, which in the long run sustains, nourishes, and impels human destinies. Once you control all of that, once you stop that spontaneous social evolution, because you have to have control over everything, and that means the schools, that means the creativity, that means the right to assemble, that means the right to have radio programs like this one where we can discuss these things openly and freely, globally. We have people in Australia, people in China that are listening to this program right now. That means all of that goes away. That means that the neural net that is now connecting all of humanity around the planet and actually helping us to evolve as a race and become aware of what's going on and maybe even empower us to prevent it. Because after all, we're not talking about fighting robots. We're talking about people. And they need us. They need us to build their cars. They need us to sew their clothes. They need us to log the wood that makes their homes, to dig the coal that fires their power plants. You think they're going to do it? No, we're going to do it. So how do we control that social change? How do we prevent, and I believe Jonathan is correct, how do we prevent this new world order from being what H.G. Wells thought it was going to be?
Well, I tend to go more... I'm a sovereignty guy. I am big on civil liberties because, and this is largely my case right now, I'm not thrilled for world government, not because of the idea of it. I think world government's fine so long as it's achieved by consent in an open process because people came to that conclusion on their own. But that's not why it's coming about. It's coming about because of manipulation. It's coming out because of secrets. That's something I don't support. My problem with global government at this stage in the game is we don't have effective national governments. We don't have transparency or accountability. We don't have real election systems. And we have it's a completely joke of a process of representatives that aren't even representatives. You can't even pass petitions anymore. They get thrown out. I watched people with thousands of signatures bring forth a petition to reinvestigate 9/11 in New York, and it was thrown out because they thought it wasn't something that people should be voting on. When they had gone through that work to get the signatures and everything, the hoops they jumped through, that's an insult to the whole I mean, we don't have a country. We have debates that aren't even open, man. We don't even have candidates that are on ballots in some countries, let alone being counted. So my point is, I'm very concerned with the idea of world government just because I don't think we have an efficient government as it is. And I watched 8 years of the Bush administration break some very serious laws, and I couldn't see the Democrats get together on anything. For some reason, the Republicans were able to get together to impeach Bush, to impeach Clinton, and they did it over perjury, and they did it very quickly. We had very serious accusations against the Bush administration, violations of Constitution, treason, releasing of CIA top secret identification. I mean, that's treason. That's grounds for hanging them. We could have kicked down the door and hung them. We had serious laws he broke, and they couldn't even show up to the articles read off of impeachment by Dennis Kucinich. Other Democrats couldn't even have the decency to show up. So I'm not thrilled about giving the government more power. They can't even do the job done that they're supposed to do. But they had the power to impeach Bush, and they didn't. And they had more in the case than anyone had against Clinton. Forget Clinton. They had more against Bush than they'll ever have. We have more against Obama than we'll ever need, and we can't even get a case against him. So I'm very concerned about a world government right now because there's no efficient government.
Well, what makes everyone think that this global leader is going to come from the United States?
Well, yeah. Well, we are. I would say that, yeah, the Western world is leading the way. But remember, we're being manipulated by interests from outside of this country. One of the places that this has some of the most momentum is over in Europe. And look at how fast Europe is centralized, and look at the European Union. And the people over there are largely awake to this. I mean, the support for not just the 9/11 conspiracy, but vaccinations, fluoride in the water, environmentally conscious. Europe is by far, their active community is not only larger, but more in touch. It also is, ironically, a place where there's much more police state activity, lesser civil liberties, and Big Brother's present. Now, isn't that a coincidence? My point is, what's going on here in the States? Is that what we're going to see? We're becoming consciously aware right at the time when we lose those abilities, those privileges.
Yeah, we are. I can tell you, if you've ever been to London, there is not a single street, and London's a big city. It stretches on and on and on. There's not a single street that you can walk down that you're not on camera.
Right.
And that's why you don't see police on every corner, because they don't have to be. Everything is digitally recorded that goes on in that city. And if there's a pattern that arises, somebody makes a purchase at a hardware store and then walks directly to an apartment, there's somebody watching that. And that's how they prevent terrorism over there. Is that happening in our country? You bet it is. You drive through Atlanta, you drive through New York, you drive through Charlotte, you're going to see cameras everywhere.
They do prevent terrorism, but they also conveniently have mishaps and jumps in the system during the times when terrorism happens. We saw that with the 7/11 bombings. There was a huge failure on the security of that country, which was more than prepared to deal with that attack. But there's also very good evidence that there's some manipulation. If you've ever seen Alex Jones's film Terror Storm, I highly recommend this film because he does an excellent job at breaking down what took place in London on those attacks. Something else to consider, it's not just big government we have to fear. Big government is what it is because the people who put those people in power also are to blame. So big corporations and lobbyists and corporatocracy. When I hear my friends talk about, well, capitalism is failing, it's the reason why we're where we're at, I say that has nothing to do with it. It's not capitalism that's the problem. It's corporatism that's the problem. We don't have capitalism. We haven't had free markets in a very long time. I studied capitalism. That's not what's causing everything that's going on here.
Oh, you're right. You're right. I mean, capitalism is what's going on in, you know, here in eastern Kentucky. You have innovative technology meeting the ability to manufacture. You have 500 people lined up outside ready to go to work. You have countries ready to ship their raw materials here. You have front page newspaper stories. You got local stories. You got television specials. And what you hear are crickets. There's
right.
no work going on because there's no banking and there's no government. There's no grants. Nothing.
Right, and there's also no free markets anymore. When 98% of the wealth is controlled and is dependent on the movements of a few deciders on the market, that's not a free market anymore. The whole
right.
beauty, the whole idea of the free market that we wanted was so that multiple interests are at play pursuing their own wealth, and it's a process by which, you know, it was beautiful when it came out. But that's been co-opted now, and a lot of the limitations that were put in place to prevent certain behemoths from getting larger, those limitations were removed, and a lot of limitations that were put in place to prevent small business people from getting bigger. And that's kind of my point with regulation and deregulation. When people say regulation's the problem or deregulation's the problem, I say, no, you need regulation and deregulation. You have to have both. We've always had limits on charters, and we've always had an open society with respect to liberty. The problem is when we make decisions of regulations, we usually don't make the correct ones. When I was talking earlier about the representatives working on behalf of their constituents, well, those constituents aren't the people. It's obvious, because if 98% of people didn't support the bailout and they passed the bailout, then the constituents aren't us. The problem is when they enforce regulations, they're enforcing the wrong regulations. They're not working for us. They tend to put regulations that prevent small businessmen from getting larger, that cost them more money. It's very depressing when you see the regulations put in place. And when they tend to deregulate, there's no ethics. They remove something called the Glass-Steagall Act, which was put in place to prevent the derivatives market from getting out of control, which is what we saw with the reason the economy crashed. So it's not that regulation is a problem or deregulation is a problem. It's that when those decisions are made, there's no ethics. They don't make them on behalf of the people's interests. They make them on behalf of private interests who are very corrupt, and that's the problem. It's not big government. It's not big corporations. It's centralized power, wherever it is, manipulating the effects of all the people.
Sure, that's exactly right. And then, you know, if you do achieve the American dream, let's say you do get your company started and you're making a profit and now it's time to go public. And so you do your IPO and the investors jump in and they buy your stock and then they dump your stock. Why? Because they're short selling your stock.
Right.
And they naked short the stock until it's down in the pennies, and then they delist you. And they have achieved their goal. They've made all the money off your company, and you didn't get a dime of it. And the biggest culprits out there, like Citicorp and Citibank, can they do it? It's illegal, but sure they do it, because the government can't stop them. He's
right.
Exactly right. It's corporatism on a global scale, and they're not manipulating millions. They're manipulating billions and trillions of dollars.
Yes, and we're starting to see now. What's really kind of scary is $1 million is not anything anymore. You know, $1 million used to be a lot. $1 million used to get you. I mean, just to give people an example, when Onassis died, Jacqueline Kennedy was only left $26 million, and that was considered an incredible, you know, treasure. $26 million today is a treasure still today, but by the standards of which we're talking about, $1 million can't even buy you a house in some places. Can't even get you a condo in New York. So, it is scary. We're seeing the first. We saw the first billionaires rather quickly, and now there's a billionaires club. You know, and I think we're going to start seeing. Believe it or not, I think in the next 10-15 years we're going to start seeing a trillionaire.
Oh, less than that. Less time than that. There are people that are manipulating countries right now. And when you have another country, and I'm just going to say it's China, that controls the debt of this country, we do not dare step out of line too far, or the bank will call the notes due. And if they do, we have two choices. We either go bankrupt, or we just say, we're not paying you.
Yeah, and that's nice.
If we do that, then it's war.
Yes. Look what Guatemala did with the IMF. They declared that the loans that they owed the IMF, they don't see them as legitimate. They're not observing the existence of those loans. They're not going to pay it back. I would predict either a high-level assassination or coup in that country very soon. So, you know, and Guatemala has a history of that. You mentioned John Perkins earlier. You know, he talks, I believe, in that book about a time when he was sent to Guatemala to try to convince the country of a few things, and he failed, and of course, as a result, they sent in jackals. So, of course, we're seeing that again right now. Guatemala is one of these countries. We were talking about this, these rogue nations, Cuba, Syria, and Iran. These are countries that are going against the interests of some of these international banks. And I've had a lot of my friends ask me, what do you think? Are we going to go to war with Iran? I say, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if Israel bombs the nuclear sites over there. But I also think that that might be too provocative, because that won't be received very well. It's not like Iraq, where Saddam Hussein was hated by Iran. It's not the same. You know, Israel does not have a green light.
Iraq was 12.5 million people. Iran's 55 million people. That's a big difference. And Iran
right.
is a very technologically advanced country. I know a lot of Iranian engineers, and they are not behind what saber-rattling this government's doing. And I'm not sure I trust our own government, that we're giving the straight scoop to our own people. Maybe they are building nuclear power plants to power their country. Maybe they want to sell their oil instead of burn their oil for their own power. Maybe they want to join the ranks of advanced nations instead of being one of the stupid that shovel their planet up, pour it in their gas tank, and burn it.
Right, and that needs to be considered for its legitimacy. The foreign policy relation between the Western world and Iran is not one that's commonly known. A lot of people don't know about both the assassination of Mossadegh, which we know was declassified, and of course even Obama was one of the first presidents to apologize for. That was a serious blow. When I still know people that don't even understand that assassination took place. Then you have the Shah of Iran. After the Shah had fallen, the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, which was violently anti-American, largely because of the coup that was caused there by the CIA and MI5. And Kermit Roosevelt had manipulated that, you know, FDR's nephew had manipulated that coup on behalf of those interests, which at that time I believe was the precursor to British Petroleum. And that coup was organized out of the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Iran. Well, the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, and they took hostages in that embassy demanding, remember what they demanded? Their demands were apologize for the coup. You know, you look at what they were doing, the Americans were being told that it was because they hated our freedoms. This is not true. It was a foreign policy issue. This was serious blowback. And as a result, the United States went into Iraq in the 80s and backed Saddam Hussein, gave him weapons of mass destruction to go to war with Iran. He ended up using these weapons on his own people and against Iran. Now we're on the backyard of Iran. We're in Iraq, and we're talking up war with Iran again. We don't have a very good foreign policy relationship with this country, and the people are not up to par on this history over there. The CIA's relationship over there with trying to multiple times overthrow that country and have coups for Western influence. So it is disturbing that there is talk of war with Iran, because I don't like knowing the blowback history with Iran, and I also don't feel comfortable with, like what you were saying. You were saying that, you know, what if they do want to be one of the more prominent countries and be, you know, at the table with the rest of them? I do believe that. There's a good chance for that. And what's scary is there's not a lot of people discussing this in a rational dialogue. They get very sidetracked with the social, political spectrum. Some people get sidetracked with the religious issue. Support of Israel sometimes comes into play. And it's hard to talk about foreign policy with some people. But unfortunately, I have to say, Iran still is one of those countries that is refusing to participate with the New World Order. So,
well, I don't know. What I see, when you listen to the president of Iran saber rattle and talk about Armageddon and blah, 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 yeah, Bush talked about exactly the same thing. I mean, these guys were like cartoon characters leading their countries.
Sure.
But the Iranian people are extremely well-educated, and they don't have the same narcissistic attitude. They're not all about nuking, you know, Tel Aviv. Keep in mind, too, that, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen Israel run a mock operation. Just the other day, they flew over Lebanon and got fired on. They routinely make subsonic races at low altitude with their jets right up to the border and then make a turn. You know, there's a lot of letting Iran know that Israel's there. And sure, there's open talk, and even, you know, everybody in Israel is in the army until you're very old. You start when you're 18 and you never get out. You're like a national guard for life. But I will tell you, you know, when there's shenanigans going on over there, and the Patriot missiles are knocking out, you know, missiles as they come in, the Israelis are not in bomb shelters. They're in the streets dancing. They're having dinner with one another. They're extremely defiant. They're not going to put up with that kind of shenanigans. And the Iranian people know this. They don't have a mission to push Israel into the sea. That's not their mission.
No, you're absolutely right. That's correct, and that's actually
country.
It's unfortunate that disinformation has so much momentum in our country. But then again, we're still feeling the echoes of a propaganda machine, which we're slowly destroying. Luckily, people like you and me are getting into radio. You know, we're in the news sites. There are other people. There are sources out there. People are starting to come to us, and it's good. These alternative news sites. This is why the newspapers are failing, by the way, because we realize what you and I are discussing. It's going to take some more time, I think, because there's still a lot of rhetoric and a support for that rhetoric. But you know, I'm optimistic about it. I do think we're winning this thing. You know, you couldn't get 1 in 50 people to discuss what you and I are discussing tonight 20 years ago. Now,
no, you couldn't. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Now it's about 1 in 3, maybe 1 in 4, and I'm not joking. Everybody knows somebody they work with or a family member that's into this stuff, whether it's vaccination awareness, whether it's 9/11, whether it's foreign policy blowback, whether it's the economy, the Federal Reserve. I've never seen such an awakening in my entire life. I mean, it's truly unique to this generation. And, you know, YouTube's only been around since 2006. I tell people that, and they're like, what? I go, yeah, man, think about that. That's the effect that we've had. We now have a voice. This information, which was not going against the propaganda machine, didn't have a way of getting out. But now, with the invention of YouTube and Google Video and DVD duplications that are cheap, and people getting into radio to save it, there's information that's readily available and is being passed around at an extraordinarily fast level and a fast pace. And people
are rapidly waking up. I was just going to talk about how fast-paced things are going before time gets away from us. We don't have a conspiracy theory theme on this program. We talk about the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. But things are moving so fast on a political level, on a military level. I mean, the guys down at Wars R Us never stop working. They work 24/7 on all 5 levels, and they're constantly cranking out war scenarios to keep their boys busy and keep the money flowing. I want to have an open invitation to you. If something comes up and it needs to get out there very quickly, you call me, and we'll get you on the radio any Sunday night you want. We'll just do a news update for 10 minutes, Jonathan Elenoff coming on and telling us what's going on. Send me an email. We'll blast it out to our newsletter people. I don't want to be an alarmist, but I can tell you what you see on the news is at least 24 hours behind the regular news. And what you see in the paper is only good for lining the birdcage. It has no relevance whatsoever. Since 1996, people are beginning to get broadband internet. The next level of instant information going out there, these social networks are just now reaching what we call viral levels, where news like this can go out not to thousands of people, to millions of people in milliseconds. Bloggers are going to maintain our freedom.
Yes, that's right. And I think it's going to even get crazier than that. I mean, we now have mainstream television now realizing that there's ratings behind this. Like I was telling you about the book I finished on trends. Jesse Ventura's show had 1.5 million viewers for the first episode when it aired live. That to get 1.5 million viewers in television in today's market, especially for something like that, was a huge success. It was True TV's number one show.
Wow.
This is a different time.
So much mail.
This is a different time right now. We're seeing you know, this stuff is popular. It's everyone's waking up, and it's just, it's an amazing time to be alive. But it's also a cautious time because, you know, interesting things happen during great times of transition. Revolutions can come about, which we're seeing right now. We're seeing more of a revolution of ideas. It's more like a renaissance. But they're also, like we were talking about earlier, 10th Amendment declarations, people are also getting a little radical. Every revolution has its assassinations and its provocateur events and its false flag events. So I tell everyone, they say, what do you think's coming? I say, I don't know, but it's going to get very interesting. So keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, and be prepared, because this is unlike any other time on this planet. And I really mean that. That's not just cliche. I really mean, seriously, this is the first time on this planet a global empire has attempted to go for it and has had no resistance. The only other times have been dictators.
It's also the first time that we as a people, China, Australia, New Zealand, South America, North America, even in Europe, we're connected real time. Right now, there are people logged into this program right now listening and writing to me from Israel, live. We are connected globally right now. Thousands and thousands of people are listening live, and millions will listen to this throughout the week. This is going to have an effect on science. It's going to have an effect on education. It's going to have effect on the oldest, most well-established mega industries in the world. Because at the end of the money chain, and I'm talking about the headwaters of the money, I'm saying at the end of the money chain, it's us. It's our dollars and our time that makes the world go. And the sooner you realize that you are empowered to control this world as a people, the sooner we will have peace.
Well said. I couldn't have said it better than myself. I'm glad that you're an optimist about it. I like to think of myself as a person of solutions. And, you know, the difference between a lot of the other alarmists out there, and I'm not really an alarmist because I don't really have anything shocking to say. Like I said, I try to find credibility if I'm going to talk about something.
But you're a journalist. I mean, what you're doing is you're finding out these sources of information. You're vetting them out, determining whether or not they're credible or not. You're cross-referencing them. And then you're journalizing it. You're bringing it to the public so that we can stay informed. And that's what I'd love to collaborate with you on. I'd like to provide you a spot anytime you need an opening, you need to get something out in a hurry. Let us know. We'll put you on.
Sure. Thank you very much. I appreciate that, and I'm sure I'm going to use that. Just out of curiosity, did you want to take calls at all, or does anyone have any questions that they want to? I don't know.
I've been in touch with the producer while we've been on. The network's full, but everybody's listening. So we got 15 minutes left. We'll go ahead and open the phone lines up. It's 415-762-1161. We'll try to get as many calls as we can in the last 15 minutes. 415-762-1161. We'll bring as many people as we can in the next 15 minutes. Don't be afraid. Come on. You know, we're friendly. I'm sitting here in my pajamas. I'm kidding. And we could have a really good open dialogue. So if someone's sitting in the studio there in California, I'm in Kentucky, just to give you an example how global our studio is. Don and the guys down there, you can go ahead and start answering the phones and putting them on. what we're going to see in the next 90 days, we're going to see a shift in national concentration. I don't think healthcare is dead. I just think it's going to go to the back room.
Right.
I think the bullet pulpit's going to be used for something else, and healthcare isn't really the focus. It's control over the money that's in healthcare. Those of you that have raised children like I have realize that you can afford healthcare. It's the insurance you can't afford. I'm about $90,000 ahead of the game because I raised four kids with no insurance. I paid for the health care as it came along. I paid for all the births and the braces and the dental work and the bones and stitches and all that. Just paid for it out of my pocket, cash. And I didn't have insurance. And I think that there's a good 10 to 20% of the populace that's out there with me. But now, as a small business owner, my most frequent visitor are the insurance companies wanting to take over our health care policies. And that's where the money is. It's not in health care. It's in insurance. So what do you see happening in the next 90 days? And I know we've talked about all these things. We've talked about the mafia and 9/11, and the only thing we haven't talked about is chemtrails. What's going to happen in the next 90 days? We're talking about an economy and a political arena that is not moving in terms of decades or even years. It's moving in terms of months and quarters.
My concern is that I think that any policy that's being pushed in on the nation seems to be rejecting, and that's what this latest election in Massachusetts shows us. What this means is that I can suspect that in the next 90 days they're probably going to move more towards selling policy on an international level. Usually what happens if there's so much resistance on a national level, other people take over. When I say take over, there's somebody who's always, their job is to be in charge of districts and areas of the planet for national security reasons. And they give daily reports and weekly briefs to somebody else and supervisors. This is just how it works. And I think that because there's so much resistance in this country, they know this, you know. And I think that they're going to go ahead and start pushing international agendas and policies. And somebody else is going to start looking at the information locally and say, maybe we need to do some provocation. Maybe there needs to be an event, or are we just going to sit back and let this happen? Because it's obvious that not only is it does it have momentum, but it's clear what its the interests are to stop these guys. And I've never seen anyone succeed at that. I've seen people get close. I've seen people get very close, but people that usually get close usually things happen. Mistakes happen, accidents happen, or the other, which is they ruin you publicly, or other things can happen. And I think that's what's going on now. Is very smart people are being called upon to sit down and think about the current situation and start creating scenarios and seeing what can we do to get out of this, to get people to stop paying attention to this, and use this to our advantage.
Well, that sounds like, for instance, when Clinton was in office and the whole Monica Lewinsky thing, which was a complete smokescreen, was starting to get some press, they just called up Wars R Us and they went and did a war in Kosovo. What the heck was that all about?
Right. Right, exactly. It's a perfect example. And the other thing is we're in the middle of this administration. I think that the war... We can't ignore the war. We are constantly at war. This hype up of Yemen is not to be underestimated. There seems to be a lot of focus on trying to increase the war and continue it further. There was those 25 Saudi soldiers found dead on the border of Yemen. That's causing Saudi Arabia to be in adamant support, which they supposedly already were. But it seems Yemen might be the next place where they will really kick up the campaign. They already are now.
I was just thinking of taking a vacation in Yemen. Mark in Ohio, you're on line one. You're on the program. Welcome.
Thanks, Dr. Agnew. I just want to make a real quick comment, and then I'll get off here. I just want to say this is a great show. And I think you should pursue this kind of show a little more often. It's so important.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
So anyway, I think you could still be X squared and positive and look at the world as it is. Thanks a lot, guys. I'll get off here.
Well, we appreciate it, Mark. All right, keep those calls coming. Yeah, I mean, you don't hear much about Yemen. I mean, what do we have? The USS Cole was attacked.
That's right.
Somewhere around there. But
John O'Neill was actually sent to investigate that, and Barbara Bodine prevented that investigation. And there's a lot of very good research into that. I unfortunately scrapped all this from my film, Core of Corruption, for time's sake, because I was already running on 3 hours. But this is all stuff I plan on releasing eventually one day or another, maybe as extras. But what I found interesting about Yemen is that it's an extremely corrupt government, and there's a strategic control of Yemen, not just in the region, but just because of the peninsula. And there's a lot of talk about making sure American supremacy maintains in the Middle East so that China can't touch it. China looks like they're going to be going into Africa. So I'm curious to see where this next event's going to come out of. You know, we still have not heard much from the Islamic Jihad or the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. Terrorism and mafia, organized crime, is very much one and the same. Talking about gun running, drug running, nuclear trading, you know, things like that, that's all generally the same groups. And the biggest terrorist networks in the world are not Al-Qaeda, they're Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah. You know, these are some of the largest. Hamas is very militant.
Yeah, but they're not very well organized. I mean, people that I know the Arab mind better than anybody on the planet. And they can tell you 9/11 could not have been planned by Arabs. They couldn't fly a radio-controlled plane, let alone a jet.
That's
right. There's no way they could pull anything off like that. You know,
right.
they're as organized as a flea market. It's just not in their nature. It's not
right.
in their intelligence networks. You know, I think one day there was something like 25 Hamas leaders rounded up. It never even made the news.
Right.
The
reason why I'm talking about this is because my concern is these networks are used to push agenda. So usually when you hear about something, those who really understand what's going on understand, you know, whatever the story is, it's usually just a cover. It's not the truth. But do they sell whatever? I mean, these administrations lately, they try to sell anything. People believe some of the craziest things. I mean, when people say truth is stranger than fiction, I mean, boy, that's an understatement, especially with 9/11. But, you know, it's kind of the problem that we're facing. We have a very powerful and large war going on in the Middle East. When you have that many operations and that many interests going against that region, expect events.
There are a lot of events over there that are happening that are not on the news. I mean,
come on.
We're not just driving up and down the highways trying to make a mark for ourselves.
Right.
We have 100,000 people committed to that theater. We have the highest tech, most advanced weaponry man has ever seen, unless you want to count the Atlanteans. Do you think a bunch of dirt farmers are going to be able to stand up against the U.S. military? No way. There's a lot going on over there, and it's a much bigger operation than what we think it is. And I don't care what they say. The whole thing over there is about oil. It isn't about anybody's freedom or revenge for anything.
Yes, it's about resource control. It's also, I think, about establishing governments that are Western friendly, not just Western friendly, probably Western fronts. It's the game of empire. War
of
is the game of empire.
Of course.
So
leaders are far less dangerous than people believe. They're
right.
just not dangerous. They're about as dangerous as cartoon characters.
Right. Well, you know what I love about the whole Bin Laden Bush thing? If you've ever read a comic book, it's always a billionaire in a secret lair underground who's planning. I mean, come on, wait a second. What was Bin Laden again? Wasn't he like this multi-billionaire in a secret lair? Remember the graphs they were showing of his lairs and underground?
Yeah, that was so
funny.
I
remember when I first saw that, I'm like, this is exactly like somebody Batman would go after. And I remember my friends laughing at that, and they're like, no, it's serious. I'm like, no, it's not, man. This is... They're not even trying anymore, man. They're just taken from comics now.
That's it. Just go to Marvel Comics. That's all they had to do. Just go to Marvel Comics and rearrange the letters, and now you got Obama. Okay.
Well, and then remember, not only did he have a secret lair, every time we got close to catching him, he'd slip away. Remember that? You want to talk about comic writing? You can't get more like a comic than that. Every time he's right within our grasp, he slips out suddenly. And he always keeps coming out with these videos right around elections, you know, and convenient times. I just thought it was funny. I still think it's funny. I'm surprised people don't see it for what it is.
Well, come on, it got to the point where they couldn't afford to catch the guy.
Right.
If they would have caught the guy or found out that he was dead, the Democrats would have cut off the funding the same day.
Right. That's right.
Well, we are completely out of time. I told you 3 hours would go so fast, and I really, really appreciate you coming on the program. And I will we'll hook up by email or Skype or something, and we'll set this thing up where we have a New World Order report update maybe once a month or twice a month.
Sure, and I really appreciate you having me on. I have 2,000 to 4,000 people that visit my website a day. I'd really like to make this show available on my website. So if you can send me this, a link,
yeah,
I would really...
We'll send the link in a couple of hours. As soon as we get it mixed down and up, we'll send you the link. And
that
way it can be out there, because I think we've had a good exchange. I'm not a broadcaster. I'm an engineer and a scientist, and I just happen to be interested in this kind of subject. It's just not the theme of this program, and so far everybody's liked it. I mean, our networks are packed right now, but not
awesome.
Many people calling in because they just like listening.
Well, maybe we'll do it again.
All right. Listen, I appreciate it, Jonathan. Definitely.
Thank you very much, and I'll talk to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, that is it for the penultimate program in January 2010. Next week, we may be coming to you from the Detroit area as we're taking the electric cars up to crash them. Might even show you the videos. We'll see you then. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.